Is the amplifier on? I can't tell. Is it on? Yeah. It's not very loud.
Bill? Can you turn the amp out? Thank the amp.
It's on.
It's on. It's okay.
Weak.
Oh, there we go. All right.
Let me turn it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Just a little weaky.
Yeah. Okay, good. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here today, just as I am so pleased to be here in Portland. My name is Jim Fetzer, and in 1992, I organized a research group consisting of the best qualified individuals to ever study the assassination, including a world authority on the human brain who is also an expert on wound ballistics, Robert Livingston, M.D., a Ph.D. in physics, who is also board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, and who therefore was an expert on the interpretation of X-rays, David W. Mantic, M.D., Ph.D. Charles Crenshaw, M.D., who was the last physician to observe JFK before he was wrapped in sheets and placed into a large ceremonial bronze-colored casket at Parkland Hospital, and who subsequently was responsible for the medical treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, 2 days later. Jack White, a legendary photo analyst and expert on the photographs and films of the assassination, who not only testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations when it reinvestigated the case in 1977-78, but also served as a consultant to Oliver Stone in producing his film JFK. And John P. Costella, another Ph.D. in physics, this time with an expertise in electromagnetism. He's an expert on the properties of light and the physics of moving objects and has made major contributions to the study of the film you're viewing now. One of the most important reasons for understanding what happened to our 35th president is that many of the same techniques and methods that were employed to conceal the true causes of his death have been continue to this day to keep the American people from knowing what has actually happened during their own history in relation to major events such as the death of Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone and in a more spectacular fashion the events of 9/11. Today we find ourselves in the anomalous position that a fellow named Hanny Farid, who's a professor of computer science at Dartmouth University, has released a study indicating his research has shown the backyard photographs of Lee Oswald are authentic, when in fact we have known for a long time that they are fakes. I will discuss the grounds for our understanding, but to me it's quite outrageous that a faculty member at Harvard who happens to have a lab that is funded by the FBI should be making at this late date in time such contributions when if he had merely conducted a literature search, which is normally the first step in any academic research program, he would have known better that there were a multiplicity of indications that there were at least 5 photographs and that even his own shadow study was hopelessly inadequate given that the shadow and the face remains exactly the same across 4 different photographs with different positioning of the body. We're also living in a world in which Vincent Bugliosi, a celebrated prosecutor from the Los Angeles area who was successful in convicting Charles Manson of his horrendous crimes and who was the author of the best-selling true crime book of our time, Helter Skelter, has now released a 1,600-page volume entitled pretentiously Reclaiming History, in which he provides a thinly veiled whitewash of the official Warren Commission report. He is, performing what has sometimes been called, when I was an undergraduate, a snow job, which is very disappointing because he's, in fact, an extremely talented man. And then we have the manifest absurdity of the President of the United States going to Oslo, Norway, to accept a peace prize while he's increasing the commitment of troops to Afghanistan by the tune of 30,000 in a war that we have no business conducting because our interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan were in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution, and he does so in the name of 9/11, which tells me that the man is either a sucker or some kind of op, because 9/11 is no justification. for these interventions. Even George W. Bush was eventually forced to acknowledge that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. A Senate investigation as well as a Pentagon investigation revealed that there was no collusion between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Indeed, Saddam represented a secular administration, Al-Qaeda a religious one. They were antithetical. Saddam was actually in the process of tracking down, incarcerating, and even killing the leaders of Al-Qaeda. And we discovered through the diligent observation of Ed Haas, who ran an online journal called The Muckraker Report, who noticed that a wanted poster for Osama bin Laden did not indicate any reason for indicting him for events related to 9/11. So he contacted the FBI, and the press officer assigned to this task by the name of Rex Toomb, T-O-M-B, told him that the reason that there was no indication or indictment for Osama in relation to 9/11 was because the FBI had no hard evidence that Osama had been involved in the events of 9/11. A reporter for INN News in New York was so stunned by what she read that she called the FBI, spoke to Rex Toomb, quoted him what Ed Haas had written in his article, and Rex Toomb confirmed that every word that Ed Haas had said was true. So evidently we have a president of the United States who must know more than our own FBI, because their conclusion is there is no hard evidence that relates them. You may even recall when the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice and all, were insisting that the Taliban should turn over Osama bin Laden for American prosecution for the events of 9/11, that the Taliban very responsibly replied that they would be glad to do so if only the United States would adduce evidence that indicated that he had been involved. With great fanfare, even Colin Powell, whom in many ways I admire, promised that we would have such a white paper, but of course it was never produced, nor could it ever have been produced, because in fact there was no reason to believe Osama bin Laden had anything to do with 9/11. In fact, even the most cursory understanding of those events tells us that if 19 of the alleged hijackers, and we have in fact no evidence from the government that they actually even ever boarded any of the planes they purportedly hijacked from Elias Davidson, D-A-V-I-D-S-S-O-N, an extremely competent scholar of 9/11, and you can find his paper by doing a Google search on his name and adding the words hijackers, government, no proof, and you'll find it immediately. If there were 15 of the 19 ostensive hijackers were from Saudi Arabia and none were from Iraq, then why within 15 minutes was Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, instructing his staff to prepare for an invasion of Iraq? Indeed, the first Secretary of the Treasury in the Bush administration reported that at the very first cabinet meeting, long before 9/11, Bush was already talking about preparing plans to invade Iraq and depose Saddam Hussein. Obviously, something's going on here. Something isn't right. We've been lied to, deceived, and misled. We know in Vietnam it ran to the tune of millions of dead Vietnamese, and some 50,000 American soldiers in Iraq were probably already responsible for the death of a million Iraqis. And the count on Americans, I say, is very unclear. It's at least 5,000. It may be many more, and all the claims we hear about troop commitments are nebulous numbers because they don't take into account the use of contractors and mercenaries. Blackwater and company aren't included in the tab. In fact, George Bush ran up the massive expenditures on these private entities so it wouldn't be calculated in the official budget for these invasions, which tells you that we're in a terrible, desperate state, that there's no accountability at the highest levels of our government. And I want to suggest to you that it began with the assassination of JFK. Now, when it comes to video fakery, those guys in 1963 weren't pikers, because what you're looking at is a recreation of the events that actually occurred on 9/11 that was used as the backbone to cover up what actually happened. Notice here the bystanders, they aren't cheering and responding. There's the vehicle. Why aren't they cheering and responding? The reason appears to be when that footage was taken of them in the foreground, the presidential limousine wasn't present. Elsewhere throughout Dallas, you would see the crowds cheering and yelling when the president passed, not here. In addition, if you look carefully, you will see William Greer, the driver of the limousine, looks back at JFK and remains looking at JFK until his brains are blown out, when he then looks forward and only then accelerates the limousine, contrary to his testimony to the Warren Commission, where he said, alleged that he had hit the accelerator after the second shot, purportedly one that hit John Connolly. But in fact, Noel Twyman, who's published a brilliant book that's nearly 900 pages long about the individuals and groups who were involved in the assassination, Bloody Treason, in 1997, hired a professional tennis player to see how fast they could do a head turn to compare it with Greer in the film, and found that Greer's head is turning twice as fast as is humanly possible, which may not sound like much, but it would turn a 4-minute mile into a 2-minute mile. There are many other anomalies here. Watch the spectacular blowout. You see that kind of blob surge of brains. That was a part of a major, very intricately constructed cover-up to make it appear as though that shot to the head had blown material out the right front of his head. We know that not to be the case, but as I'm going to explain, the altered x-rays to support it. Life magazine had an issue which had a comment saying that the direction in which his brains were blown out to the right front showed the direction from which the bullet had been fired above and behind. We have Zapruder, Abraham Zapruder, who's alleged to have taken this film, though when he testified in New Orleans at the Clay Shaw trial, he said he couldn't remember that this was the film he took. Going on television and talking about a blowout to the right front, which is quite startling, all things considered, since Jack Kennedy's brains were blown out to the left rear, not to the right front. So you have even Abraham Zapruder testifying to an event that never took place, which means that Abraham Zapruder and Life magazine and those who were responsible for the x-rays and those who recreated the Zapruder film were engaged in an intricate cover-up, the details of which I shall elaborate. But even Jackie reported on the way to Parkland Hospital immediately after the assassination, in her testimony to the Warren Commission, that from the front he looked just fine, but she had a terrible time holding his skull and brains together at the back of his head. Well, he would not have looked just fine if, in fact, his brains had been blown out to the right front. And this is one of multiple deceptions that were used to perpetrate a fraud on the American people and to deceive us from learning what actually happened. In fact, what took place in Dealey Plaza that made all this re-editing of the film especially important is that William Greer, right about this vicinity, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed. Hitting a moving target is very difficult, even under ideal conditions. They had to bring it to a halt to make sure he would be killed, and during that interval of time, he was hit twice in the head, once from behind. He fell forward. Jack eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple with a frangible or exploding bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that the motorcycle patrolman to the left rear hit by the debris thought he himself had been shot. And a big triangular chunk of his skull, of which I will show you a photograph, was found in the grass the next day that had been blown out. While that was taking place, a motorcycle patrolman by the name of Cheney, who was on the right rear, motored forward to tell Jeep Curry, who was in the lead car, that the president had been shot. And remarkably enough, we have testimony not only from Chief Curry and this motorcycle patrolman and other motorcycle patrolmen, but even Winston Lawson, who was in charge of the Secret Service in Dallas, who was riding with Chief Curry, all of whom confirmed that Officer Cheney had motored forward. Also, there are two women standing in the grass. You'll see one in the red coat, that's Jean Hill, and standing beside her friend Mary Mormon, who was using a Polaroid camera to take photographs. They both reported, testified, they stepped out into the street and called out to the president. Mary said, "Hey, Mr. President, turn this way. We want to take your picture." And Mary wound up taking a photograph that was taken an instant after the bullet hit his right temple. You'll see them here in the image just right in the moment. There they are. But they were in the street when they took the photograph. So what you have here is a three-field composition. You have the foreground, which was done using footage that was taken before the assassination. You have the mid-ground, where the activities that are taking place have been altered using the techniques of optical printing and special effects. And you have the background, which was used to create a frame, but where, you know, watching this, you think that's a vast green expanse. If you actually go to Dealey Plaza, you're startled because you've been looking at this vast green expanse, and it's actually relatively contracted and not very expansive at all, leading some of us to believe that the background may have been subjected to a form of magnification to fill up the field. It's also an oddity of this footage that you notice as it gets closer to the assassination. The vehicle almost disappears into the foreground. That's very peculiar. What happened to the rest? All the other footage, and there were about 8 different chunks of film that were taken of the motorcade at different parts, though the Zapruder is the most important. And then the next film taken from the opposite side, the second most, keep the limousine clearly centered. So why does the limousine suddenly all but disappear down into the foreground? That's very odd indeed. Not only that, but we have a colleague by the name of Richard Della Rosa who's actually seen the unaltered film on 3 different occasions. Don't ask how this should happen. But Rich has told us, and all this is included and published in the third of the three books that came from our research, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, that when the driver brought the car to a halt, he did so in a very abrupt fashion, and it jostled the passengers who were thrown forward. Now, interestingly, they kept some of that footage of the passengers being thrown forward. So when JFK is hit, if you can take your eye off of his brains and look at the passengers, you'll see that John Connolly and Nellie Connolly and Roy Kellerman and William Buer are thrown forward rather than backward, which is very odd. But I think they felt that some bystanders might have noticed this jostling, and in order to make it more consistent with their memories, therefore they kept it in an odd event. Now, it turns out that our research on the alteration of the film has now been corroborated by the work of a member of the Assassination Records Review Board, a five-person civilian panel created by an act of Congress after the resurgence of interest in the assassination generated by Oliver Stone's film JFK. They passed this act over the adamant opposition of then-President George Herbert Walker Bush, a former director of the CIA, who refused to appoint the members to the board, which then was delayed for 18 months until the Clinton administration came into place and made those appointments. The only party who could override their declassification decisions was the president, and Bill Clinton never overrode them on any of these. But a member of the staff of the Assassination Records Review Board, by the name of Douglas Horn, has just published five volumes based upon his research and experiences as a member of the board. And just to comment on his volume four, which addresses the Zapruder film issue, he had the intelligence, just as Noel Twyman had, to consult experts in Hollywood. Noel Twyman had brought a special effects expert by the name of Roderick Ryan to his home in Rancho Mirage, California, to look at the film with him, and Roderick Ryan told him that both the blob, this bulging out to the right front, and the spray of blood had been painted in. So what Doug Horn did to complement that was to bring a couple of experts at the restoration of films. They've been involved in restoring some 200 films in Hollywood. And they blew the film up onto a really big screen, and they were just appalled by the amateur character of the forgeries that were involved. They were actually performed by painting these effects into the film, including to the back of the head to conceal the massive blowout to the back of the head. So we have a very powerful source of indication in great detail where a lot of this work appears to have been done at Kodak Laboratories in Rochester, New York. I'll elaborate on that as we proceed, but I just want you to know that there's a tremendous amount of evidence substantiating the observations I'm making here about video fakery. Well, he's a former director of the CIA, and he was very confident that if, in fact, research were conducted in a competent fashion, it would reveal that the CIA had played a major role in the assassination, as I shall explain. So here we have what is going to turn out to be a very thematic image of JFK and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Jack Ruby, who was one of the few involved in the assassination who had a conscience, observed, among other interesting statements, that if Adlai Stevenson, for example, had been JFK's vice president, the assassination would never have taken place. And I'll elaborate for you on why that is undoubtedly the case. The best information we have as to why Lyndon was even on the ticket with JFK is that Lyndon and J. Edgar Hoover, who were extremely tight, used information they had about John Kennedy's romantic liaisons with a large number of women to blackmail him on the ground that if they didn't put Lyndon on the ticket, then they would release this information to the press. And, of course, if they had done so, that would have guaranteed that Jack would have lost. So by putting Lyndon on the ticket, it didn't guarantee they would win, but avoided what appeared to be a sure loss. Now, this was an example of the ruthlessness and brutality of Lyndon Johnson, whom I shall subsequently observe as the most fascinating character ever astride the American political scene, because he had so many strength, both for good and for evil. And I shall articulate and elaborate on indications we have that tell us, I think, to a high degree of confidence, in my opinion, beyond any reasonable doubt, his role in the assassination. Now, we've discovered more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit. Bear that in mind. More than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting the man up for the hit. When the Assassination Records Review Board telegraphed to the Secret Service that they wanted records of their previous presidential protection of the president on motorcades early in the year. Not only did they not comply, they destroyed those records. And, of course, for good reason, because if you actually know what the Secret Service did here, it's utterly appalling. For example, two agents who normally would have ridden on the back of the limousine or beside the limousine were left at Love Field. Emory Roberts, who was riding in the Secret Service Cadillac, which followed the presidential limousine, called them off. He was in charge of the detail. These were not his only actions that were very odd. For example, when John Reddy, who was on the right running board here, began to respond when the shots first rang out in Dealey Plaza, Emory Roberts called him back and wouldn't let him respond. Reddy was ready. Emory didn't want him to respond. The motorcycle arrangement was quite bizarre. It was cut down to four, which is a ridiculously small number. If you ever saw Charles de Gaulle do a motorcade in France, for example, there was an arrangement of 30, 60, 100 motorcycles. And the two officers who are most important to you are number eight, Officer Hargis, who was hit with all that debris, and number nine, Officer Cheney, who motored forward after the limousine was brought to a halt. So you had William Greer, the driver, Roy Kellerman, the agent in charge, Nellie Connolly, the wife of Governor John Connolly, Jackie Kennedy, and JFK. There had been a great argument that morning between Lyndon and JFK over who would ride in the presidential limousine. Lyndon wanted Ralph Yarborough, whose liberal Senate nemesis, to ride with JFK. Jack, however, overruled him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. But I think because Connolly was there rather than Yarborough, and there wasn't any time to notify the shooters that Connolly was in fact wounded during the shooting, and because he was a conservative Democrat like Lyndon, indeed one of Lyndon's closest allies and cronies, it obfuscated the political aspects of the assassination that would not have been the case, I think, if the liberal Ralph Yarborough had been the other person who was shot. Notice how the Secret Service did not cover the windows. I mean, this is an absurdity. Look, you know, Jack even had told Jackie that it would be easy for him to be assassinated because someone could do it with a rifle from a building. But the Secret Service knew that the first measure you take is to secure all the windows. You determine who are the occupants, if there was anyone who was a threat to the president who worked in any of those buildings. Absurdly, according to the Secret Service's own survey, there was no threat to the life of John F. Kennedy within 100 miles of Dallas, Texas, which is about as ridiculous as it can be, because this was a hotbed of anti-communist activity. They hated JFK. They talked about shooting people like him on the streets when they saw them. And broadcasters in Dallas after the assassination said that a communist had killed John Kennedy because he wasn't turning the country communist fast enough. Notice how the crowds are spilling out to the street. They were 8, 10, 12 deep. The 112th Military Intelligence Unit, which ought to have been distributed through the city for crowd control, was ordered to stand down over the adamant opposition of its commanding officer. Although motorcade routes are standardly fixed months in advance so the Secret Service can investigate all the buildings and occupants, just a few days before, on the 18th, this motorcade route was changed. Instead of proceeding up on Main Street, where you could get onto the Stemmons Freeway, or indeed Industrial Boulevard, both of which would have taken you to the location where JFK was to speak, a phone call, which I believe was simulated by John Connolly to the White House with Secret Service agents present, elicited the concurrence of the White House to make a change in the location where he would speak, which was then used as a pretext to take this 90-degree turn from Main Street onto Houston and then a 110-degree turn back onto Elm Street. Elm Street was a one-way street. You could have come up Elm Street and turned here in front of the book depository, but you wouldn't have had to slow down. I'm convinced the reason for this change is that by making this 110-degree turn, you slowed down the vehicle without alarming the occupants. Now, if there had been a lone demented gunman on the sixth floor here, then his best possible shots would have been as the vehicles were turning, coming up Houston toward the book depository. The body, the torso, the head is getting larger and larger. It's an easier and easier shot. As I'll explain, Oswald was a mediocre marksman, and his weapon was completely inadequate. But if he had had a halfway decent weapon, that those shots from that location wouldn't have been very difficult shots. On the other hand, waiting until after the vehicles turned the corner, were driving away, and he had to fire through a tree. There was a large, large oak tree here, which was abundant with leaves, which is well portrayed in Oliver Stone's film, was a relatively preposterous undertaking. In fact, there was an internet game called JFK Reloaded, where you had the opportunity of using a far superior weapon with a properly aligned sight. It didn't have a double action trigger. It didn't have a bolt that threw you off the target when you fired it. So you had this superior situation, and you were given the opportunity to try to replicate Lee Oswald's marksmanship, which presumably was two hits and one miss. Thousands of people attempted with this superior arrangement, and the highest performance in replicating Oswald's feat was a 0.795 out of 1,000. That means the best they could do was a C+. They didn't even get a B in grading for trying to replicate Oswald's shooting. But of course, as I will explain, Oswald wasn't shooting anyway. So calling it Oswald's shots is a fantasy, but that's the kind of fantasy the government has sold us, not only in this instance, but in others, including 9/11. All the vehicles, most stunningly, were in the wrong order. Normally, a presidential limousine is in the middle. You have the lower-ranking dignitaries ahead them, such as the mayor and then the vice president, although the vice president normally is not supposed to be in the same motorcade with the president. But then the crowd will cheer for the mayor. Their cheers will grow for the vice president. Eventually, to the president, they'll go crazy. If you put the president in the first limousine, as was done here, then, of course, they cheer for the president. They might turn away and not even notice the mayor or the vice president were there because they came to see the president. So that was absurd. They canceled the flatbed truck that would have preceded the president's vehicle on which the television newsmen with their cameras would have ridden. This was a major political event. Not only that, but they took the president's military aide, who normally would have ridden in the front seat of the presidential limousine between the driver, William Greer, and the agent in charge, Roy Kellerman, and put him in the very last vehicle of the motorcade, along with, guess who, the president's personal physician, Admiral George Berkeley. So if the president did need emergency medical attention, he would have been in the least advantageous position to access it. Another peculiarity about this motorcade is, while normally formal motorcades are all uniformly black limousines, typically Cadillacs, in this case, they're all different makes, models, and colors. Very peculiar, unless, of course, you wanted to know exactly who was in each limousine by easily identifiable color, make, and model, which appears to have been precisely what was going on here. During the assassination itself, as I've already mentioned, William Greer pulled the limousine to a left, well, after bullets had been fired and Jack was hit twice in the head. By the time they got to Parkland Hospital, an agent with a bucket and a sponge began to wash the blood and brains out of the limousine. Obviously, this was destruction of evidence taking place already at Parkland Hospital. When several observers there, including a motorcycle patrolman who actually inserted a pencil through the hole in the windshield, threw him through a hole in the windshield, they moved the vehicle so that bystanders couldn't notice its features or properties. There was a dent over the chrome strip in the windshield. This is one of at least three misses that took place during the assassination, as I shall explain. Here is the interior of the limousine, though it's rather tidied up. It was sent back to Ford Motor Company already on Monday, the day of the formal state funeral, and it was stripped down to bare metal, and the windshield was replaced, and the entire vehicle was restripped. We have the billing of Ford Motor Company for $1 million for rebuilding the limousine. It was a crime scene on wheels. It belonged in the Smithsonian. Ultimately, it should have been a subject of detailed forensic analysis. The person who would be responsible for having this done would have to be either the head of the Secret Service by name of Rowley, or the director of the FBI, J. Edgar, or the president, Lyndon Johnson himself. Now, this is after the assassination. If you look at the time clock, you see it's about 2 o'clock at the time, and the assassination took place at 12:30. And it occurred right in this vicinity on Elm Street. You would think that the police might have had the sense to mark it off as a crime scene. Instead, they allowed traffic to proceed through and contaminate the scene immediately. And this is just an indication for you to see how blatant it was, the failure of the police to treat the scene as a crime scene. I should mention, by the way, the only crime that had been committed was murder. There were not then any statutes against the assassination, even of a president or a vice president. When they got to Parkland, JFK was brought into trauma room number one. When 2 days later Lee Oswald would be brought in, they put him in trauma room number two. The physicians who were present included Dr. Carrico, Dr. Perry, Malcolm Perry, who actually performed a tracheostomy in a vain effort to resuscitate him, Dr. McClellan, who you'll find later would certify a drawing of the massive blowout to the back of the head. Dr. Kemp Clark was the director of neurosurgery. Here's Dr. Crenshaw identified on this diagram. Here's Dr. Berkeley, the president's personal physician, and Mrs. Kennedy. Obviously, this is a static diagram of a fluid situation because people were moving. The most touching aspect of the entire situation is when Jackie approached Dr. Jenkins, who was the anesthesiologist, and extended her hand, asking if this would help, giving him this chunk of skull and brains that she had picked up off the trunk of the limousine when she climbed out. Jackie knew a great deal about art, literature, music, culture. She knew nothing about neurology, brains, ballistics. Very sad. He was pronounced dead at 1 o'clock, though as I shall explain, he died instantly. Here we have Malcolm Kilduff, the acting press secretary, explain it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head while pointing to his right temple. This wound, plus another to the throat, would be widely broadcast on radio and television that afternoon, including, for example, on NBC. If you go back and watch their broadcast footage, you'll see Chet Huntley, for example, reporting that there was a wound to the throat and there was also a wound to the head, and later explaining that it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head, attributed to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician, that it entered, eventually that it entered the right temple. So that in the evening, by the time the evening occurred, and the reports were coming in that the assassin had been above and behind, no less a newsman than Frank McGee said, "This is incongruous. How can the man have been shot from in front, from behind?" And, of course, that was the basic conundrum that confronted the Warren Commission, which led them to the solution of simply reversing the trajectories of these wounds, as I shall explain. Now, the assassination took place at 12:30. Nevertheless, they put out an all-points bulletin for somebody who looked rather like this man, whose name is Lee Oswald. There must have been, you know, hundreds, even thousands of young men in Dallas who were approximately 5'10 and weighed approximately 165 pounds. But they zeroed in on him when a shoe salesman near the Texas Theater reported that this man had entered the theater without buying a ticket. In response to that rather minor infraction, we had a dozen police cars, including detectives, and descend upon the Texas Theater, where after a minor scuffle, during which Oswald said, I'm not resisting, he was brought out. Now, he had two forms of identification in his wallet, one for Alec Heidel, another for Lee Oswald. They hadn't actually inspected the wallet, and yet as they came out of the theater, when one of the bystanders asked, "Who have you got there?" one of the detectives responded, "Oswald." Quite remarkable that he knew who he had even without conducting any investigation. Here is the arrest report on the prisoner who's been under investigation, right? And it is timed 1:40. So the assassination took place at 12:30. And by 1:40, a little over an hour, they already had their man. Not only did they have their man, but let me read you what this actually says. It's not that this man is a suspect and who knows what he did. It says, "This man shot and killed President John F. Kennedy and police officer J.D. Tippit. He also shot and wounded Governor John Connally." Now I say, with this caliber of investigative competence, it's very difficult to imagine how we could have ever survived without the Dallas Police Department. Now, this particular photograph, and this is a photograph that Hanny Farid, this computer scientist, has claimed to have vindicated by studying the nose shadow, has many signs of alteration, including the fingertips of his hand are cut off. The jaw is not Oswald's jaw. Oswald had a jaw that was pointed with a cleft. There's an insert line here between the chin and his lower lip. The newspapers he's holding are for the Militant and the Worker, two communist newspapers, but with antithetical views. Such that a colleague of mine on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, who has written studies of the history of communism, told me they were so at odds that if groups of them encountered one another, they'd break out in fights and try to kill each other. So this is very odd that he had this, the Mandlicher Carcano. There turned out to be four different versions of this. The face is exactly the same in all four versions, which is, of course, most peculiar. And when Lee Oswald was shown one of these photographs by homicide detective Will Fritz, who was in charge of the investigation, he told him, that was his face, pasted on somebody else's body. He knew something about photography, and with time he'd be able to prove it. Well, he was absolutely right. With time, we have proven it. even if an FBI stooge who happens to have a tenured position at Dartmouth wants to make a claim to the contrary. Now, here you have the official account of the assassination, three shots fired from the sixth window. By the afternoon of the assassination, the Secret Service and the FBI both concluded there had been three shots with three hits, that Jack had been hit in the back, about 5.5 inches below the collar, that Connolly had been hit in the back, and then Jack had been hit in the back of the head. That was their conclusion on the day of the assassination, which, to the best of my knowledge, they have never revised. However, when the Warren Commission was appointed by Lyndon about a week after the assassination, and would learn, after it was some weeks into its investigation, that there was a distant bystander, James Tigg, who has been in this location number 6 down here, who had been injured by a shot that hit the curbing and then actually cut his cheek, they realized they had a problem, because there had been clearly at least a miss, so they had to subtract from three shots with three hits to three shots with two hits and one miss, which led to the introduction of the magic bullet theory as come to be known. This is Tagg, and here you can see some scarring on his cheek. Another shot appears to have missed here, and this seems to be a residue from its having impacted near this manhole cover. The magic bullet theory that was the product of the fertile imagination of Arlen Specter, then a junior senator, claims that a bullet entered the base of the back of the neck, traversed the neck without hitting any bony structures, came out the throat just above the thigh, went in the back of John Connolly, shattered a rib, exited his chest, went into his right wrist, and wound up in his left thigh.
Yeah.
This is not only preposterous on its face, but notice this diagram, which comes from Gerald Posner's book, Case Closed, which was an easy version of the Warren Commission report. Doesn't even have the bullet entering at the right place. Notice that's not the base of the back of the neck. That's somewhere down on the jacket. And, of course, you'll understand why Posner would shade his efforts that way as I proceed through the evidence. Now, here's one of the official Warren Commission diagrams. The Navy artist who drew these was not allowed to see the body.
Yeah.
Purportedly, of the two wounds, here's this one at the base of the back of the neck and this other that entered the back of his head and then blew out the brains to the top or to the right front, as it's shown. These aren't completely consistent because, of course, they're fabricating and trying to make it come out right, which they're never quite able to do.
Didn't they all shoot toward over the trunk of the car? They didn't go at the front. The brains, his head.
Oh. Well, I'll talk about that. They cleaned up the brains in the car and cleaned them off. In the Zapruder film, they cleaned the brains all off the trunk. In fact, we have Secret Service agents who, when they saw JFK's brains all over the trunk, got nauseated. Vincent Palomar, who's a leading expert on the Secret Service, interviewed them. So here you have even Doonesbury getting the act. You know, what do we got? We got one guy, three shots. You know, he's kind of lucky. Or do we have this very complicated multiple assassin scenario, many shooters, you know, all kinds of odd figures involved here. So he says, you know, which one? You make up your mind. You know, which one is right? But, you know, you prefer a simpler theory only if it's adequate to account for the evidence. I've already shown you evidence for which a simpler theory cannot account, such as the dent in the chrome on the windshield. I mean, so if it can't account for all the evidence, a simpler theory isn't worth a hoot. It's been refuted by the evidence. So you have two versions that are closely official. You have the three-shot Warren Commission, and then when the House Select Committee reinvestigated, it decided, based on disputed acoustical evidence that actually appears to be quite good and wasn't fully developed, that there had been a fourth shot from the grassy knoll, but that had missed. There are many alternative accounts, however. 6 seconds in Dallas, Farewell America, Computers and Automation, Cover-Up, JFK, The Case for Conspiracy, High Treason, The Killing of a President. What I present here will show you that the 8, 9, or 10-shot scenario is closer to the truth, so that I will explain all of that. Here you have a nice representation, then, again by the same Navy artist, of the purported magic bullet. We're supposed to have entered at the back of the base of the neck, traversed the neck without hitting any bony structures, and exited the throat. However, when we look at the evidence, we get a different impression. Here's a jacket JFK was wearing. It has a hole about 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column. Here's the shirt JFK was wearing. It has a hole about 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column. Here is the official diagram by J. Thornton Boswell, who assisted James Humes at Bethesda Naval Hospital in conducting the autopsy. Neither of them had ever performed an autopsy on a gunshot victim before. Right here you see in Boswell's diagram, there's a wound to the back about the same location, 5.5 inches down below the collar. And here you notice the same diagram with the same wound is verified by Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. Here we have an FBI diagram. This is by a fellow named James Siebert, who with Frank O'Neill was actually a witness to the autopsy. And his diagram shows that the wound to the back was lower than the wound to the throat. So it's very odd that you could have a bullet fired from above and behind go down a lower location and yet come out at the level of the throat. Here you have the president's personal physician's own death certificate. Admiral Berkeley executed a death certificate saying he was killed by a shot to the head, but observing there was a second wound to the back, the posterior back, at about the level of the third thoracic vertebrae. So here you have a physician who well knows how to give an accurate medical description of the wounds. So where is the third thoracic vertebrae? Well, guess what? It's about 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column. Some apologists for the commission have claimed, well, the reason the holes are in the shirt and the jacket in the wrong place is because they were bunched up. So, you know, they actually, while the wound was higher, the holes would look lower just because they were bunched up. Well, this is absurd on multiple counts, including the fact that JFK was a wealthy man who wore custom-tailored shirts and jackets. They don't bunch up. Plus, of course, even if you had a claim that the shirt and jacket had bunched up, that wouldn't account for why you have the mark on the autopsy diagram that corresponds to the location on the shirt and the jacket, nor why the FBI diagram would corroborate it, nor why the president's own personal physician's death certificate would give an exact location that wouldn't correspond to the bunched up hypothesis. So it's very clear that while some of these efforts persist to this very day, that they appear to have no basis when you scrutinize the evidence. Indeed, even the Warren Commission staff believed that Jack had been hit down at the base, you know, below the base of the back of the neck. Here you see a reenactment using, interestingly, the Secret Service Cadillac, where you see a large patch for the wound to the back and a much smaller one at the back of the head. This is my favorite photograph from the history of the assassination. You see the young Arlen Specter holding a pointer that shows the trajectory the magic bullet would have had to take if that hypothesis were true. And yet below his hand, you can see by quite a few inches, there's the patch on the stand-in where the bullet actually entered, which means that a photograph intended to illustrate the magic bullet hypothesis actually refutes it. It's stunning. You might think that the Warren Commission staff was the only personnel in the United States who didn't know that JFK was riding in a Lincoln limousine when he was assassinated, but by performing their reenactment in the Cadillac, which has different dimensions, different distance of seats from the ground and so forth, different distributions of passengers and so forth, you completely destroy any forensic significance of reconstructions. And that appears to have been a principal motive of the pseudo-investigation, to make sure that no one would ever be punished for any involvement in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now, when the Assassination Record Review Board began releasing its documents and records, they released one of great interest to us that showed that Gerald Ford, who was then a junior commission member as a representative from Michigan, had the description of the wound to the back changed from his uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck to make the magic bullet theory more plausible. When Gerald Ford was questioned about this after these records were released, he confirmed that he had done that. He said, however, it wasn't in the furtherance of any conspiracy theory, which is, of course, his typical maluse of language, because no one's talking about a theory here, talking about a conspiracy to cover it up, not a theory about it. But that he'd done it for the sake of historical accuracy, except what he was introducing was a major falsification of the medical record. David Mantic, who is board certified in radiation oncology, took a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions to JFK and created a CAT scan and plotted the official trajectory, which shows the bullet entering here and supposedly coming out there, but where there's a major problem, namely that cervical vertebrae intervene, which means that the alleged magic bullet trajectory is not even anatomically possible. So, you know, we're not only told a theory about the magic bullet that's false and provably false, it's not even anatomically possible. Now, Michael Batten, who chaired the medical panel for the House Select Committee when it reinvestigated the case, said that if the magic bullet theory were false, he made this observation on the 40th observance of the assassination, then there had to have been at least 6 shots from at least 3 different directions. Now, Michael Babb no doubt thought that was a way of bolstering the magic bullet theory, because who would imagine there could be as many as six shots from at least three different directions? But if I'm going to lay out now, you'll find we've not only falsified the magic bullet theory, but we've shown there were at least six shots from at least three directions. Now here, if you consider what we're told, you know, when you know where the bullet actually entered, then you see how preposterous its trajectory turns out to be, because it enters here, you know, 5.5 inches, or in relation to the shirt, 5.75 below the collar, then takes this stunning reversal in an upward and 90 degree to the side trajectory, and then comes out the neck to enter Connolly's back and all that. This is quite preposterous. And yet here you have the bullet that's supposed to have done all of this, the magic bullet, which is virtually pristine. It shows some longitudinal distortion, but none of the kind of damage that a bullet performed a fraction of these feats would be expected to display. For example, by firing bullets into the wrists of cadavers, they found you got a substantial mushroom effect of the bullet, but there's no mushroom effect here. Now, at 3:16 Eastern Time, or 2:16 Central Time, Malcolm Perry, shown here, and Kemp Clark, shown here, had a press conference with reporters during which they explained that Dr. Perry had performed a tracheostomy through this wound to the throat, and three times he identified the wound to the throat as a wound of entrance. He said it was a wound of entrance. He said the bullet was coming at him. He said, you know, three different times. Now, this transcript was never provided to the Warren Commission, nor, interestingly, were the shirt and the jacket that the president was wearing. They were left behind at Parkland. The transcript was never provided to the Warren Commission. To the best of my knowledge, it was first published in Assassination Science, which was the first of the books that resulted from our research, in 1998, where that news item about Gerald Ford came out just in time for me to include it in the book. Kemp Clark had pronounced him dead at 1 o'clock, though, as we're going to discover, he was, in fact, killed in Dealey Plaza. Here is Charles Crenshaw's description of the wound to the throat, just a small, simple, clean puncture wound to the throat with an incision across it, straight line incision after Dr. Perry was done. When Bob Livingston, world authority on the human brain and expert on wound ballistics, because he'd supervised an emergency medical hospital for injured Okinawans and Japanese prisoners of war during the Battle of Okinawa, heard this description on the radio, he knew it was a wound of entry. So when he returned to his home on Burning Tree Road in Bethesda, where he was employed as a scientific director of the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Institute of Neurological Diseases and Blindness, which are located across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital, he decided to call the physician who was going to be involved in the autopsy, and the officer of the day put him through to Commander Humes. And he explained to Humes that since there was this shot to the throat, that he had to dissect the wound very carefully, dissect the neck very carefully, because, and this is so ironic in retrospect, if there were any evidence of shots from behind, then there had to have been at least two shooters and therefore a conspiracy. Their conversation was cut off by the FBI. Bob Livingston couldn't understand why the FBI would interfere with a conversation between physicians, especially in a matter of this importance. But of course, that is because they had a different scenario in mind and would re-describe the wound as a wound of exit. In fact, one of the reasons for believing that either the autopsy photographs or the body itself were altered is the size, the dimensions of this wound to the neck in a purported autopsy photograph. Notice, too, by the way, that JFK's eyes are open here. Charles Crenshaw was the last to view him and close his eyes before he was wrapped in sheets and placed in this bronze ceremonial casket. Right up here, you see something that looks an awful lot like a masking tape right here where the wound entered the right temple, okay? There's something very bizarre about the ear here. Look on both sides. The ear looks highly abnormal. We have stories of a physician, a surgeon who is very skilled with a scalpel by the name of Leggett, who appears to have been involved to reconstruct JFK's right ear, because the exploding bullet that entered the right temple did so with such force that it not only blew open this flap here, this skull flap here, but also destroyed his ear. So that Leggett, apparently, who was this clever, actually reconstituted an ear. But yet, look how odd it is. Notice, too, we don't see the massive blowout to the back of the head here, which is very strange, because that's where all the physicians, we have over 40 witnesses, as I'll explain, to the blowout to the back of the head. So here you have, again, this is just to remind you, now we've already dispatched this wound to the base of the back of the neck, right? We know that's a false location intended to bolster the magic bullet theory, that wound was actually well down right about this vicinity instead. So what then about the wounds to the head? Here you have Dr. Crenshaw's diagram of the wound of the head. It was a massive blowout at the back of the head. He said to me it was the size of a baseball, by which I take it he meant a hardball, or the size of your fist when you double it up. You double up your fist and put it in the back of your head and ask about a blowout of those dimensions, and you realize this was a huge, gaping, massive wound. And yet here, and these are photographs and diagrams of the House Select Committee, which relocated the entry from down here, where the Boswell and Humes had originally located, to the top of the head, and where you can see in this diagram, there is something that looks like it might be an entry wound, but it's not present in the photograph itself. Notice, too, how short and well manicured is JFK's head. But there should be a massive gaping wound in this vicinity, which is not present. Here's one of the stunning examples of forged photographs. Look at this massive gunked-up head, which Robert Grodin, who's a leading expert on the photographs and films as well, has produced in color. This is truly nauseating, but it's also clearly a fabrication. We during the course of questioning of the physicians by the Assassination Records Review Board, we had the opportunity to pose questions for them to ask, and one of them, which I believe Dr. Manick suggested, was the patient given a shampoo and a haircut during the autopsy? And of course, that's an absurd idea, and Humes replied, no, 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 no. But look at this here, and look at that there. How can those possibly be the same patient during the same autopsy, unless something fantastic like that occurred? In fact, these are clearly fabricated photographs that have been, you know, used to obfuscate the record. Here's a diagram of the blowout to the back of the head that Dr. McClellan authenticated, and which looks a great deal like what it appeared to be. There are witnesses right there in Dealey Plaza, Beverly Oliver, Phil Willis, and his wife Marilyn, Ed Hoffman, a deaf mute who is up behind the triple underpass, who saw one of the shooters. The physicians at Parkland were uniformed: McClellan, Peters, Saylor, Carrico, Delaney, Crenshaw, Jones, Nurse Aubrey Bell. Here was a justice of the peace there in Ward. Aubrey Reich was the ambulance guy who helped load the casket into the casket. So that when Jesse Ventura had his television program, Jesse Ventura's America, he featured Beverly Oliver, who explained how she'd seen the blowout occur to the back of his head in Dealey Plaza. Aubrey Reich, who reported how he had felt it with his hands when they placed the body into the casket. And me, to explain how they'd altered the x-rays to conceal it, but that in fact the blowout was precisely as they described, which had occurred from the shot to the right front. Here's Frank O'Neill, who was Siebert, of course, with the FBI agents press, and then Gerald Custer, Paul O'Connor, and Floyd Reby, who were all among the technicians who were assisting at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Now, the actual removal of the body from Parkland Hospital was in violation of the law. And Theron Ward opposed it initially, but the Secret Service men brandished their weapons. So this is yet another indication of Secret Service complicity in the assassination of JFK. Now, here's a pre-mortem, or while alive, x-ray of JFK's skull. Here I've inverted the Cecil Stoughton photograph to give you an impression, you know, the general idea of where the x-ray aligns with the cranium. David Manick thought there was something very suspicious about these autopsy x-rays because the degree of contrast is so massively greater here. In fact, the degree of contrast between black and white in these autopsy x-rays was on the order of 500 to 1,000, whereas in the normal x-ray it might be on the order of 2 or 3. So he suspected something was wrong. Before he went into the National Archives for the first time, which was at the very end of 1992, he told me he thought he could discover evidence of a second shot to the head, but also evidence that the x-rays had been altered. And I told him, David, I said, we have what we're looking for either way, because there's clear, you know, incompetence or cover-up by the government. He used a simple technique from physics known as optical densitometry to measure the amount of light that passes through the x-ray and discovered there was this area at the back of the skull, which he refers to as area P for patch, that had been created by the exposure of material that was much too dense to be ordinary human bone. So that the only way this x-ray could have been created was by using material that was so dense that the only way it could be a naturally occurring phenomenon is if the back of JFK's head was nothing but solid bone. In other words, unless JFK was a bonehead, this was an artificial contrivance intended to conceal this massive blowout to the back of the head. Here's that fragment I told you about, this triangular chunk that was found by a medical student by the name of Billy Harper in the grass to the left of where the limousine had been located when Jack's brains were blown out. He took it to relatives on the hospital staff of Methodist Hospital. who x-rayed it and photographed it and identified it as from the back of the skull. Now, it had occurred to me that, in fact, those who were reconstructing the film were paying so much attention to the frames 3, 13, 14, 15, 16 at the vicinity of the blowout to the head that they might have overlooked that the back of his skull might be visible in later frames. And in frame 374, I found you can actually see the blowout to the back of JFK's head, which resembles almost exactly the diagram that David Mantic had uncovered. And here you see that flap of skull opened up, right? And you don't see his ear here, of course, and it's probably because it was blown off. Now, David also studied the anterior posterior x-ray, and you notice here, you see, you got this big chunk of missing mass in this x-ray. Big chunk of missing mass in this x-ray, see? So where it's very dark, that's mean there's been lots of exposure, meaning there was practically no density to what was being exposed, and if there were missing mass, it would look like this. And that appears to have been to complement that bulging out that was painted in the Zapruder film. So we have, you know, a very clever attempt to create the impression that the bullet came from behind. They also added a 6.5 millimeter metallic sliver. Now, experts on ballistics have said they've never seen a metallic sliver like this. It was on the back of the skull. And it appears to be that it was, you know, intended to implicate this obscure Mandukar Carcano that Lee Oswald was alleged to have used to perform the assassination. In doing so, however, they committed a blunder, because the Warren Commission report, the House Select Committee, even articles that would appear in the Journal of the American Medical Association all confirm that JFK was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets. It turns out the Mandukar Carcano only has a muzzle velocity of 2,000 feet per second and is not a high-velocity weapon. So we have the simplest possible exoneration of Lee Oswald as the assassin. The weapons he is alleged to have used could not have fired the bullets that killed the president. David did find additional indications of a second shot in the distribution of metallic particles. This is from a shot that entered the right temple and were distributed in accordance with the laws of physics, where the heavier particles traveled further than the less heavy particles, which is indicative of the shot that entered the right temple, the explosive, frangible bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head, which had already been weakened by another shot to the back of the head. The physicians had found a piece of bone that had beveling on the interior, which is indicative of a shot having come from the outside to the inside. So there were those two shots to the head that Jack endured during that brief interval when the vehicle was brought to a halt. Now, Robert B. Livingston, World Authority on the Human Brain, has observed that we have two principal kinds of brain tissue involved here. One is cerebellar, from the small compact part of the brain at the base, and the other is cerebral. Now, if they're blown out, they'd look quite different. Cerebellar would have kind of a reddish, granular, hamburger-like cast, whereas cerebral would be more grayish and maggoty-like. So it's a kind of difference that even a first-year medical student couldn't mistake. And yet we have reports from the Parkland doctors. Dr. Jenkins, cerebellum had protruded. Part of the brain was herniated. Cerebellum was hanging out. Dr. Carrico, both cerebellum and cerebrum. Dr. Perry, some cerebellum was shown. Dr. McClellan, cerebellar tissue had been blasted out, as well as cerebral. Baxter, cerebellum was present. Dr. Kemp Clark, cerebral and cerebellar tissue were dangling and exposed. And what's fascinating about that is that the diagram shown in photographs and drawings in the National Archive show an intact cerebellum. In fact, this is an abnormally large brain. It weighs some 1,500 grams, whereas a normal adult brain weighs between 1,350 and 1,400 grams, as I learned from Dr. Livingston, where his study of the reports of the physicians and of these diagrams led him to the following conclusion. It simply cannot be true that the cerebellum could have been seen extruding from the occipital parietal wound by several experienced and thoroughly competent physicians, and for the same brain to be seen in superior and lateral photographs and depicted in a drawing, superior view, showing the cerebellum as being apparently intact. A conclusion is obligatorily forced that the photographs and drawings of the brain in the National Archives are those of some brain other than that of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now, it turns out that Douglas Horne, whom I have mentioned already as a senior military analyst, had already discovered that there had been two separate supplemental autopsy exams of a brain, one done the same day the vehicle was reconstructed, the other about a week later, and it appears that in this interval the substitution of brains was effectuated. Here you have now the mortician who prepared the body for the funeral, who is giving a report by a phone during a phone interview to an independent investigator by the name of Joe West on May 26, 1992, describing the wounds. Large gaping hole in back of head patched by stretching piece of rubber over it, thinks the skull was full of plaster of Paris. Smaller wound in right temple, crescent-shaped flap down. That's that flap of skull that I explained was blown out. Approximately two small shrapnel wounds in the face packed with wax. I'll return to them. Wound in back, 5 to 6 inches below shoulder to the right of the backbone. Adrenaline gland and brain removed, other organs removed, and then put back. No swelling or discoloration to the face. Died instantly. Well, what about those small shrapnel wounds? Well, as I will explain, the bullet that hit Jack in the throat passed through the windshield. That's the hole the motorcycle patrolman was putting his pencil through before they moved the vehicle away. And David surmised, and this was very astute, but this guy is, the superior medical authority on the assassination of JFK, that they were small shards of glass. When the bullet passed through the windshield, the small shards of glass penetrated Jack's face, so that when the mortician attempted to embalm him, they started to leak out, and he had to patch him with wax.
Wouldn't there have been small holes in the people in front of Jack, too?
Well, there might or might not have been. I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't know of reports to that, but it's an interesting question. What I would point out, however, is that, remember, JFK's military aide, who ought to have been sitting in between Kellerman and Greer, was moved to the very last vehicle. If the military aide had been sitting in his normal position, he would have been hit in the head with a bullet, which would not have made the transit to JFK's throat. This is a very interesting medical, evidence photograph. The FBI and the Dallas police made photographs of the evidence as a record, and what's striking here is it showed only two expended shell casings and one unexpended. That's very odd, because this Mannlicher Carcano had the odd feature that you had to load it with a clip of 7 rounds or it wouldn't function. And once the clip had been loaded, it fell out of the weapon. So here they should have 7 rounds, expended and unexpended, and they only had 3. Not only that, but this is a paper bag with which Lee Oswald is alleged to have brought the Mannlicher Carcano assembled or disassembled into the book depository. I do not know how many of you are familiar with weapons, but steel is very unforgiving. This bag would have been oily and torn and tattered if it actually had been used for that purpose. And you don't have to be a former Marine Corps officer who used to supervise recruit training at the same recruit depot and rifle range where Lee Oswald took his training to make that observation. Here's another official FBI physical evidence photograph showing two expended shell casings and one unexpended. Now, there's some apologists for the commission who want to claim, well, yeah, one of the officers put one of these expended shell casings in his pocket and carried it around. You remember during the O.J. Simpson hearing, there was something about some tennis shoes which were taken home, a similar oddity. But the fact of the matter is, as I've already observed, there have to be 7 casings altogether, even if there were one that had been treated sloppily, which is a bit of a stretch in the case of an investigation, the assassination of a president. There had to be 7 altogether, and we only find 2 expended and 1 unexpended. Here's a Mannlicher Carcano. Now, this is a really interesting story. I've already explained how it's not a high-velocity weapon and cannot have fired the bullets. This is an evidence photograph taken in Dallas. Here's one taken by the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C., and guess what? They're not the same weapon. So if you compare the relative location of the scope, the trigger housing, and all that, the one even has this elaborate strap, which the other is lacking. So what's going on here? Notice the scope. The same relative positions of the same relative parts should be in the same location, and they aren't. The scope's too far back here on the bottom. Doesn't extend far enough forward. The strap, other features, they aren't the same. And in fact, here's a Lieutenant Day who's carrying a weapon from the building, purportedly it's just been found. And it does have what looks like a clip in it, except that, as I said, the clip should have fallen out, so it shouldn't be present. So I introduce, Lieutenant Day's weapon into the mix, and guess what? It doesn't align either. So there appear to have been at least 3 different Mannlicher Carcanos that have been palmed off as the assassination weapon. And notice in this case, even the strap doesn't look the same as the strap on. We don't even have a strap here. I mean, this is really rather blatant stuff. Now they conducted a nitrate test on Lee Oswald, and they found he tested positive for nitrates on his hand, but negative on his cheek. Now he fired a rifle or carbine, he'd be positive on his cheek. And what's interesting about this is, while some apologists want to say, but he washed it off his face, he couldn't wash it off his face without also washing it off his hands. So the fact that it wasn't on his cheek but was on his hands is doubly exculpatory, including the fact that he worked in a book depository, and nitrates are used in ink that is used in the printing of books, and since that's where he worked, it's extremely unsurprising that he would have nitrates which were not incriminating on his hand. You had a question?
You stated that the clip should have fallen out. I'm just not familiar enough with weapons.
Yeah.
I thought I heard you say earlier that it came out after all seven shots had been fired.
Right. That's so right. No, not fired. Not fired. Had been loaded. Yeah, this is unlike the M1, unlike a military weapon where the clip only pops out after you fired all the rounds. Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, loaded, yeah. So what's our successful assassin, the most powerful man in the world, purported to have done after he has taken him out? Raced across the warehouse floor, stashed his trusty man liquor carcana, raced down four flights of stairs for what? To rush into the lunchroom to have a Coke.
Yeah.
Now, isn't that what you do? Isn't that what you do? So later, of course, realizing that the work wasn't going to take place, he actually walks out the front door, where he encounters a newsman, Robert McNeil, as I recall, who asks him for directions for a telephone, which he provides. And according to the official account, he catches a bus, which gets bogged down in traffic. He exits the bus to take a taxi to get to his landlady's house, but a little old lady wants a taxi, so he graciously offers her the cab. Now, this must be the only case in world history where the fleeing assassin uses public transportation to make his escape. In fact, there are many problems here, including that at 11:50, William Shelley saw him near the lunchroom when Shelley came down to eat lunch, that at noon, Eddie Piper saw him on the first floor when Oswald told him he was going up to eat. At 12:15 p.m., Carolyn Arnold, who was the executive secretary to the vice president, observed him sitting in the lunchroom. At 12:25, she saw him again, but on the first floor near the front door. Now, the assassination took place at 12:30, and a motorcycle patrolman by the name of Marion Baker confronted him in the lunchroom, where the officer drew his revolver and held Oswald in his sights within 90 seconds of the assassination. So all that fancy footwork Oswald is supposed to have done is supposed to have taken place within 90 seconds. But now, and just to render the official account all the more incredible, Robert Groden has announced that he has an additional witness who at 12:30 was providing change for Oswald to get that Coke out of the machine. Her name appears to be Geneva Hein. She has been in fear of her life and asked that he not release this information until she was deceased, which is now the case, and I'm quite sure he has her on tape. So we even have a woman at the very time Oswald was inside the building getting change for his Coke when they heard what they described as firecrackers. Now, he's supposed to have gone home on that cab and got out away and then walked up to his landlady's house, changed his jacket, and got his revolver. And walked up to the Texas Theater, which he could have done if he'd gone straight forward on this route I'm showing here. This would take you over to the Texas Theater. But according to the Warren Commission, he made a detour. He turned left here and went way out of his way, where he had an encounter with a police officer by the name of Tippett. Now, it's interesting that his landlady said that a police vehicle, while Oswald was in the room changing his jacket, pulled up in front of the house and honked several times, which appears to have been a signal. But allegedly, he went over to shoot this police officer. Remember that arrest record, Sandy? He also shot and killed police officer J.D. Tippett? Well, there are a lot of interesting aspects to this, which Robert Groden, in his book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, has beautifully illustrated, which is the following. There were four shell casings found at the scene. The officer was shot three times in the torso and once in the head, interestingly in the right temple. But of the four shell casings, there were two different manufacturers, two of Western and two of Remington Rand. And they were automatic cartridges, meaning they had automatically been ejected from the weapon or weapons. Aquila Clemens, a woman across the street, said there were two men who shot the officer. Neither of them resembled Oswald. The first officer on the scene took those rounds and initialed them. Subsequently, there would be a substitution in the record because Oswald had a revolver. He didn't have an automatic. So Oswald's rounds wouldn't have automatically been ejected. Plus, the size of the shell casings is quite different for a revolver and an automatic. But in the course of events, there would be a substitution in the evidence, and the automatic casings with the initials would be replaced by revolver casings without initials. But now there'd be three of one make and one of the other. I mean, this is the blatancy with which this kind of nonsense has taken place of framing this man. Here's a photograph during the assassination where shots have already been fired. In fact, Jack has already been hit in the throat. If you look carefully, this is a very famous photograph by an AP photographer by the name of Ike Alchins. You can actually see the through-and-through hole. There's a small white spiral nebulae right here where JFK's left ear would be visible if it weren't present, and there's a dark hole in the center. Then in the background you see what some have thought might be Lee Oswald. Actually, we know now he was in fact in the lunchroom, as I've explained, but he had a co-worker by the name of Billy Lovelady who looked a great deal like him. Here is a window in the closet of a uranium mining operation that was a CIA front from which three shots appear to have been fired. I believe these were the only shots fired with an unsilenced weapon, and that they were fired with a Mannlicher Carcano, which accounts for the fact that we got one hit to the back of the head and two misses, the one that injured the distant bystander and the other that hit the chrome strip. And then you see, while Jack's security detail is unresponsive, Lyndon's security detail is already alert and in action to protect the vice president of the United States. Now, here's that windshield again. You can see quite clearly that white spiral nebulae with a dark hole in the center. Yet this is what a windshield that the Secret Service would later produce. Now, remember, the vehicle was taken back and completely rebuilt. We've even found the official who replaced the windshield, confirmed the through-and-through hole in the windshield. And it was a clean windshield when it came out of Ford. So what happened is that the Secret Service had obtained additional windshields, they claimed, for target practice. Bob Livingston had heard about this, in order to create a mock-up, a simulated shot from the rear with cracks. But this crack windshield is completely different in its characteristics from the windshield with a through-and-through hole in it, which shows the extent to which the Secret Service was willing to go to conceal the true causes of death. So we have Jack having been hit four times. He was hit in the throat by a shot that appears to have been fired from an above-ground sewer opening at the triple underpass. He was hit in the back by a shot that appears to have been fired from the county records building, that 5.5 inches down below the collar, shallow shot, only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger at a 45 to 60 degree downward angle. And then while the vehicle was stopped, he was hit in the back of the head by a shot from the Daltex, that window I showed you, and then from this above-ground sewer opening at the north end of the triple underpass. So here's the whole scenario. I mean, it was quite a shooting match. We have an officer who appears to be by the name of Harry Weatherford, a sheriff's deputy, who was stationed on top of the building with a high-powered rifle and a scope. It was a .30-06. It wasn't a Mannlicher Carcano, but it appears as though he used the .30-06 to fire the 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano using what's called a sabot, a small plastic collar that enables you to fire a lower caliber a bullet from a higher caliber weapon. And it may be because it was using that sabot that it was such a shallow penetration. Now, there's an interesting story here that Jim Mars told me just the other day during an interview about how the sabot had been found by a Minuteman in Dealey Plaza who'd given it to the head of the Minutemen, who was subsequently subjected to an FBI raid, and they took all of his stuff, and when it was finally returned, the only thing that was missing was the sabot. Plus, in addition, that a cartridge from a .30-06 was found on the roof. Then the three shots were fired from the Daltex, the one that missed and injured the distant bystander. See how that's a perfect straight trajectory? Then the other that missed and hit the chrome strip, and then the other that hit Jack in the back of the head. I'll identify that shooter, who was an anti-Castro Cuban, in a moment. Then from the opposite side of the Daltex, no shots were fired from the alleged assassin's lair, but from the opposite side, as many as three shots were fired by who may have been Frank Sturgis, who was a CIA involved in anti-Castro activities, that hit Connally. What's most interesting about the Connally shots is the following, to wit, that Connally said he turned to his right to see what was going on, couldn't see, so he turned around to the left, and that's when he felt this doubling up in his chest. Well, turning around to his left, feeling the doubling up, meant the shot came from the side. So we not only have Jack hit from the front and from the rear, but we have Connally hit from the side. And if you were just to take the four shots that Jack suffered, the one shot that missed and one shot in Connally, you'd have got six shots, so that we have not only shown that the magic bullet theory is false, but that there were at least six shots fired from at least three different directions. Then you have a shot here from the grassy knoll area, and I believe this was fired by a Dallas policeman who was also working for the CIA by the name of Roscoe White. And then we have two shots here. This was the shot from the south end of the triple underpass, one of the first shots that passed through the windshield. and hit JFK in the throat. I believe the shot was fired by Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was a hitman for Lyndon. He killed as many as 11 people, including one of Lyndon's own sisters for Lyndon Johnson. Madeline Duncan Brown, one of the two persons close to the assassination I got to know personally, I had over 100 conversations with Madeline, was a mistress of Lyndon. They began an affair in 1948. She bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950, not his only child out of wedlock, but his only male offspring. And she told me, because she was herself a trap and game shooter, that the 2 weeks for the assassination out there at the ski club, Malcolm Mack Wallace was there every day practicing, and he never missed. He was a phenomenal shot. I believe that shot was fired by him. And then there's a fellow by name of Lewis, who is an expert in the Air Force, who I believe fired the shot that hit JFK in the right temple. This fellow went to work for the dealership, the car dealership that provided all the vehicles for the motorcade, just a week before the assassination. The day of the assassination, he turned up back there nauseated and all covered with mud, apparently having had to make his escape through these sewer tunnels beneath and what this means is, if I'm right, is you had some shots fired by, you know, Lyndon's personal, you had a military expert, you had a Dallas policeman, you had a Dallas deputy sheriff, you had a CIA guy, and then you had an anti-Castro Cuban. So, you know, each of them were entering into kind of a blood oath by putting up one of their own shooters. Lyndon was a really hands-on guy, okay? We know from Billy Saul Estes, for example, who published a book about it, that Lyndon sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the details, all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. After the assassination, these three persons were found in a railway car behind the parking lot, behind the grassy knoll, which was used by the Dallas Police Department. The first is a fellow by the name of Charles Rogers. A book has been published about him called The Man on the Grassy Knoll. Apparently, he was living with his parents, and they apparently became suspicious that he might have been the assassination. So he murdered them, dismembered them, and was flushing them down the toilet piece by piece. When the police raided the house, he made his escape. They didn't catch him, but he appears to be a nasty piece of work. The second guy here, the tallest of the three, Charles Harrelson, the father of the actor Woody Harrelson. Charles Harrelson is doing a life term for the assassination of a federal judge with a high-powered rifle, a very rare event in American history, but very like the assassination. And the third of the three is a fellow by the name of Chauncey Holt, who I got to know. Chauncey had an unusual history. He was from a circus family, trapeze artist. He was an expert shot. He at one point ran a school for assassins. He had several contracts put out on him, but the other fellow, shall we say, did not prevail. At one point, Chauncey Holt was the accountant for Meyer Lansky. Now, if you know anything about the history of the mob, you understand Meyer Lansky was the brains that organized the modern Cosa Nostra. And Chauncey impressed Meyer during a conversation about mathematics, where he's talking about division by zero. And Meyer said, well, of course, division by zero means zero. And Chauncey corrected him. He said, well, no, actually, it's infinity, because there are infinitely many nothings in something. And Meyer was so impressed with Chauncey, for that and other reasons, that he, you know, made him his accountant. Chauncey was also a painter, a forger, a counterfeiter. He told me about his work for the CIA. He described how the CIA has all these assets and proprietaries with these innocuous sounding names, and how he had done work at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery store, where there was a five-story building. The bottom three were legitimate businesses, and the top two, the CIA ran its counterfeiting ID operation, where they counterfeited the Alec Heidel identity for Lee Oswald, for example. But where Chauncey was given instructions by his handler, Philip Twombly, to prepare 15 sets of forged Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. Chauncey was very worried he might not get the color-coded pins, you know, the color code for the pins that the Secret Service would wear that day, but he did get them in time. He was instructed to go to that parking lot behind the grassy knoll and leave them in a red pickup truck. He told me when he got there, the truck wasn't there, so he wandered around Dealey Plaza. He said he saw more bad guys, mercenaries, and assassins than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention, which I think was quite deliberate, so that they'd create a lot of false leads. If anyone started looking at who was there, who had been present, they would go in a hundred different directions. He returned to the parking area and found the pickup truck was there. He left the ID, and he and the other two, headed down for the boxcar. While they heard shooting taking place, they had been told to get into a boxcar that would appear to be locked, but wouldn't be. He told me when they got in there, they found it was loaded with ammunition, weapons, and explosives. My belief is that if the Lee Oswald scenario hadn't worked out, these guys were the fallback, and they would have been held as responsible as the assassins. As it was, they were marched to police headquarters. They were not booked. They had a casual conversation. Chauncey had a paper bag, you can see there, where he had an interesting custom-made weapon and a radio that was highly unusual. So he had a conversation, and then they were released.
Why weren't they booked? I mean, like a natural thing to do, wouldn't it?
What's natural about this assassination? I mean, look, if you got the Dallas police in collusion, they're not going to work with book people who had a role to play in relation to the assassination. And, you know, these guys did. Now, here's a good one for you. So they're being escorted by officers who are in non-standard, you know, equipment and uniforms, and somebody walks through. Now, many of you have seen the film JFK. There's a composite character there by the name of Colonel X, who actually represents Fletcher Prouty, who was a liaison between the CIA, the White House, and the Pentagon on covert activities. Fletcher was sent down to South America, South Pole, on some ceremonial activity. He was actually in New Zealand when he got a newspaper that showed up. Studio quality photograph on the front page. But the point is that he looked at this photograph and he knew who this person was. His name is Edward Lansdale. He was responsible for assassinations all over the world for the CIA, especially in Vietnam. And his identification of Lansdale was confirmed by no less an expert than Victor Krulak, who was the commandant of the Marine Corps, who, when shown this photograph and asked, you know, for his identification, confirmed that from the walk, the stance, the hand, the ring he wore and all that, that this was certainly Edward Lansdale, who many of us believe was, in fact, the person who was responsible for organizing the assassination in Dealey Plaza. So here he appears to be passing through just a signal to these who were involved in the assassination that everything's fine. Now, here's that image in Life magazine, and let me read you the note 6. The direction from which this shot came was established by this picture taken in the instant the bullet struck the rear of the president's head and passing through caused the front part of his skull to explode forward. Now, you see how clever this is. What's fascinating about this caption is that they broke the plate for this page twice. I guarantee you this has never happened in the history of publishing before or since. They broke the plate twice so that they could refine this caption to make it just right to complement the X-ray deception and the Zapruder film deception. Now, here are the frames 3, 13, 14, 15, 16. David Lifton, who's wrote the brilliant book Best Evidence, published in 1980, which is a meticulous study about the medical evidence and was from which I learned more than any other source when I became serious about the assassination. Notice that when these frames, where you get that back into the left effect, were published in the supporting volumes for the Warren Commission, they were in the wrong order. So that if you publish them in the wrong order, 313, 315, 314, 316, then it greatly mitigates that back into the left effect. David Mantic believes that it was not a part of the actual event, sequence of events in Dealey Plaza. No witness testified to seeing the black back into the left. And my inference is, and anyone who has military experience will understand what I'm saying when I say this, somebody didn't get the word. Okay, it was supposed to be published in this sequence. Hoover tried to get away with correcting the sequence when they published the volume, but David Lifton caught him, had his girlfriend write to Hoover, and amazingly enough, Hoover wrote back and confirmed that the frames were published in the wrong order. Now, this is very interesting because if you're following the properties of light and so forth, such, if you're following the limbo and it's going to be precise, then background features are going to be blurred, as you see here. So if you're following the limbo, then you get this, the limbo is fairly sharp, but the features are blurred. In this frame, however, if you're following the limbo, how can you have sharp features in the background? The only way that's possible is if the limousine is stationary, not moving. So here you have Mary Moorman and Gene Hill, who are taking their photograph, and as I explained, they stepped out into the street. Gene, who was the more aggressive of the two in a red coat, called out, "Mr. President, look over here, we want to take your picture," right? And Mary took the photograph, which I'll show you. Here it is. This was taken just a fraction of an instant after Jack was hit in the right temple. Part of his skull is right there on his shoulder. And this has become an object of great controversy because Jack White found a feature internal to the photograph identified here that creates a line of sight on which the photograph had to be taken. David Mantic and I went down with surveying equipment and to check it out and confirm Jack's finding that in order for Mary to have taken this photograph, she had to be in the street. But it generated a huge controversy, especially attempts to discount Jean and her claim that they'd stepped into the street because Jean said she had seen a little dog in the car, and everyone thought that was ridiculous, a little dog in the car with Jack and Jackie. And yet it turns out that we have photographs like this one that shows, in fact, Jackie was given a little puppet, which is the puppet known as Lamb Chop, Sherry and Lamb Chop. And there are several photographs now we have, so that the little dog actually vindicates Jean Hill. I can't begin to tell you how much she was, you know, verbally attacked and demeaned for having said there was a little dog. And she said, he and Jackie were looking at a little white dog in the middle of the seat. Sounds absurd, but there it was, Lamb Chop. Now, what Jack has noticed in some of the photographs in Dealey Plaza, you find Zapruder in an impossible position to take the film that bears his name. For example, here is his secretary, Marilyn Seitzman. Zapruder was a little uneasy with heights. I've climbed up on this low colonnade myself. It's very difficult to imagine how Marilyn Seitzman, wearing a dress, could have climbed up there and preserved her modesty. But nevertheless, according to the official story, she's up there with Zapruder, except in some of the footage we have, it looks as though she's blocking Zapruder's access to the limousine. And in fact, of course, we now know that in fact the film we have today is a composite made from multiple sources using optical printing and special effects. And here's Zapruder that night testifying to this blowout to the right front that did not occur. So it's really quite fascinating that there was this elaborate interlocking form of deception between the Zapruder film, the X-rays, Life magazine, and Zapruder himself. Now here's that photograph that appeared on the cover of Life magazine, which Hanny Ferret of Dartmouth College claims he has exonerated because he was able to replicate the nose shadow. He doesn't talk about the other shadows. He doesn't talk about the clipped off fingers. He doesn't talk about the chin or the insert line and all that. Now, this guy turns out to be not only an expert in detecting photographic forgeries, but has a lab that is run by the FBI. So that I have now written the president of Dartmouth twice explaining that something is terribly wrong here, and that Hanny Ferret appears to have abused his position and suggesting, I called it a modest proposal, that Dartmouth should convene a panel of experts to review his work and to straighten this out because it's going to permanently stain the reputation of that very fine college. Here is a study by Jack White where he took the known measurements, the known dimensions of the newspapers as an internal yardstick and measured from the bottom of his foot to the top of his head and discovered that using that yardstick, the individual in the photograph is too short. We know Lee Oswald was 5'10" in his shoes, 5'9" without them. The individual here is about 5'6", which means either they used someone too short as the stand-in for Oswald, or they used newspapers. When they put in the newspapers, they put their dimensions in too large, which may be the more probable. I take it, by the way, Jim Mars believes that, in fact, there's also a funny bump on the arm here. That is very strange. And, of course, with the chin, he believes that it was Roscoe White who was the stand-in for Oswald in those backyard photographs. And, of course, you see, in each of these photographs, the face shouldn't be exactly the same, and yet if you put them together, they are exactly the same. So, you know, that's just another proof of fakery. You can find a lot more about this. In fact, there's a new expert study that shows even Hanny Ferret's study of the shadow of the nose isn't done properly. Now, think about the impact of this research I've been describing. It's really quite powerful. For example, The mob's been accused of being the responsible for the assassination, but the mob could not have extended its reach into Bethesda Naval Hospital to alter X-rays under control of the Secret Service agents, the president's personal physician, and Navy medical officers. Neither pro- nor anti-Castro Cubans, for example, could have substituted someone else's brain for the brain of JFK. The KGB, even if it had the technical competence to do so, equal to that of the CIA or Hollywood, could not have recreated the Zapruder film because they could never have got their hands on the footage they needed to do it, nor, of course, could any of these things have been done by Lee Harvey Oswald, who was either incarcerated or already dead. Here we have an interesting photograph and very touching because Jackie looks so cheerful, and this is only seconds away from the assassination. And what's odd here is these two large trucks. We find it anomalous. They are present. We believe this large van may have been the command and control center for the assassination. It's certainly odd that it's in that location. It could conceivably have also been a shooting location, although I believe I've identified all of those already. Here's a photograph from Dealey Plaza of a man taken right above JFK's head who appears to be Lucien Conin, who was a very famous CIA assassin. He was also a close associate of Edward Lansdale, so it has been said that if Lansdale was somewhere, you'd find Conin very nearby. A fellow by name of Alan Eaglesham has sought to argue that this person and this are all the same, and that this person was married to a woman in the area and actually got received a plaque for having been captured in this photograph. But this is a clear case of disinformation. Jack has studied, and in fact the features of this man and this man are the same, but of this man in relation to the other two are different. Here's one of his studies showing the differences between them, and it's very disturbing to me that this fellow, who is known as Alan Eaglesham, who I had supposed was doing very good work, should be trying to sell us a bill of goods when we have photographs of Lucy and Conin here in Dealey Plaza. In fact, I wrote to the editors of the Wisconsin State Journal about a photograph they had that was accompanying an article about a book by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, which advances the absurd theory that the mob assassinated Jack and then blackmailed Bobby from investigating because they discovered plans for the invasion of Cuba. I mean, if they discovered plans for the invasion of Cuba, which are preposterous on their face, because after the Bay of Pigs, Jack made all these solemn commitments to the Soviet Union and so forth, the United States would not reinvestigate Cuba. It would have been preposterous. But if he had been going to betray the nation, then the mob would have waited till he invaded Cuba. They wanted to regain the control of their resorts and casinos where they were running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. They most certainly would have let him do that first and then taken him out. So this scenario of Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, and Tom Hartman is otherwise a pretty good guy. I mean, I listen to him often on Air America, but this book is rubbish. In fact, the first version was entitled Ultimate Sacrifice, and my review, if you find it in Amazon.com, is entitled Ultimate Rubbish. So here we get again, we get the difference between Lucy and Conin. You see the difference between the bridge of their nose, the distance between their eyebrows and so forth. This is just an indication of the brilliance of Jack White's work. And he also looked at the plaque. Now, it's ridiculous somebody gets a plaque for appearing in a photograph, right? That's ridiculous. But the plaque is a very flimsy forgery. It claims he was pictured above the motorcade above JFK on Thursday, November 23rd. They didn't even get the date right. I mean, it was Friday, November 22nd. So, you know, the idea that Alan Eaglesham should be proposing this plaque as a way of showing that this man wasn't actually Conin is really a sign of desperation. I'm acutely disappointed with him. On the other hand, there are quite a few other interesting photographs in Dealey Plaza, including this. As the limousine is turning from Houston onto Elm, we have six different agents, officials of the CIA who appear to be present. Tracy Barnes, Rip Robertson, Ted Shackley, David Sanchez Morales here, Eddie Bayo, number two, and Grayson Lynch. It appears these guys turned out to pay their last respects to the President of the United States. The particularly telling cases are Rip Robertson and David Sanchez Morales. Morales was a notorious assassin for the CIA. He was involved in the killing of Che Guevara in Bolivia. And to make sure there wouldn't be any rumors that Che was actually still alive and going to be resurrected, he actually severed the head of Che from his body and kicked it 100 yards away just to make sure no one would be under any illusions as to whether or not Che was dead. Here's another rogues gallery of individuals appear to have played a role. James Angleton, who was the notorious paranoid anti-espionage head for the CIA, apparently thought that Jack was... or somebody in the government was betraying secrets, so he prepared top secret documents in five different versions to find out who it was and discovered, lo and behold, it was JFK himself who had provided Nikita Khrushchev with this confidential document. He thought he was, you know, betraying the country. John McCone was a replacement head of the CIA after Jack removed Alan Dulles, but appears to have been kept in the dark about what was going on. Clay Shaw, of course, would be tried down in New Orleans, and it would eventually be admitted by the CIA. He did work for them as a contract agent. E. Howard Hunt has sometimes been claimed to have been the third tramp, but he was not. It was Chauncey Holt. Howard Hunt has, however, given a confession tape to his son, St. John, about his role, that he was a backbencher at the assassination, but those he fingered for involvement included Lyndon Johnson, Cord Meyer, who was then in charge of operations, David Sanchez Morales, another notorious assassin by the name of William Harvey, and so forth. Richard Helms here appears to have had a key role in the assassination. Here is Lucien Conin in yet another photograph. This is George DeMorin's child, who was Oswald's handler in Texas. David Attlee Phillips, who's one who collaborated with Roberts and Morales in assassinations and appears to have arranged this phony visit by Oswald to the Cuban embassy in Mexico, which did not take place. In fact, the CIA had photographs and audio tapes that showed that this person was not Lee Oswald, that were so important that J. Edgar Hoover actually put out an information directive to his heads of stations informing them that somebody was in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald. And I say, if that's all you knew about the assassination, if that one fact were all you knew about the assassination, you'd know enough to realize this was a conspiracy. Bradley Ayers was an Army captain who was assigned to J.W. Wave down in Miami. Two minutes, we'll be there. In Miami, and met a lot of these players, and even identified some of them, not only as being ones he concluded had been involved in the assassination of JFK, but identified them in photographs in the Ambassador Hotel where Bobby was taken out. It includes George Johannides and David Morales and a fellow by the name of Gordon Campbell, who was Bradley Ayers' own case officer. And, you know, that to me is quite stunning and suggests that they were attempting to clean up some loose ends because Bobby had let it be known that he would reinvestigate the case of JFK. If you were to visit Little Havana, you would find that in a Freedom Park there, they have, you know, two statues, one to Jose Marti, who actually led Cuba to emancipation from Spanish domination, but also this fellow by the name of Nestor A. Tony Escudero. And it's really kind of funny that Tony Escudero has a statue to him in this Freedom Park in Little Havana, but it turns out that Tony Escudero has been identified by Gary Patrick Hemming and by James Richards as the gunman who was in the Daltex building. So this is the guy who appears to have fired the three shots, the one that hit Jack in the back of the head, the one that hit the chrome strip, and the other that missed and injured the distant bystander, and therefore he is there. Others who have visited Little Havana and asked about how come Tony Escudero has that statue was told in a somber tone of voice that he took care of business. Now, the argument's been made that no one ever talked about the assassination. Jack Valenti, for example, in Noel Twyman's book, Bloody Treason, was published, claimed there can't have been a conspiracy because no one talked. Well, if he'd actually read, you know, page 285 of Noel's book, he'd find that's false. It includes, for example, that Carlos Marcello, one of the, you know, the big mafiosi, Santos Traficante, both talked about Jack going to be hit. Joseph Miltier, an FBI informant down in Miami, bragged that Kennedy would be killed, how it would be done. Johnny Rosselli, Sam Giancana's right-hand man, who was deeply involved in all these things, told Jack Anderson that Ruby was their man in order to silence Oswald. David Attlee Phillip acknowledged it. Lyndon Johnson told Madeline, let me tell you this story. This is a great story. I've got a couple good ones for you. The night before the assassination, there was a social event at the home of Clint Murchison. There were only about 24 people there, but they included not only Clint Murchison, of course, the great oil baron, and H.L. Hunt, his nominal competitor, who described himself as the richest man in the world, but J. Edgar Hoover, who frequently came and stayed at the Murchison home on his way to California with his close personal friend Clyde Tolson, where he'd go to the Del Mar racetrack and lay down bets, and when Hoover bet his horse would win, turns out that Del Mar is owned by Clint Murchison. J. Edgar Hoover was there. Not only that, but Madeline remembered Richard Nixon was driven out there by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank where she was a young advertising executive. George Brown of Brown and Root Heavy Construction was there when the Vietnam War went down. Brown and Root was given the contract to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, even though Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports and it wasn't really needed. John J. McCloy was also there. He was our former High Commissioner to Germany, also the former Chief Executive Officer at Chase Manhattan Bank. And when Lyndon would create the Warren Commission, he would appoint as the two civilian members Alan Dulles, whom Jack had removed as Director of the CIA, who was deeply involved in the assassination, and John J. McCloy. So in addition, Lyndon showed up unexpectedly late in the evening and these heavy hitters disappeared into a meeting room for 15 minutes or so. And when it broke up, Lyndon strode toward Madeline and told her. She thought he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow he was going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys. They had a liaison on New Year's Eve 6 weeks later at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas. where she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out. And I say to you, the only person who could have saved John F. Kennedy's life was Lyndon Johnson. And of course, it wasn't in his interest to do so. He was in the midst of several scandals. Even Richard Nixon had been reported in the Dallas Morning News that day that Jack wasn't going to run with him again, that he'd already told his executive secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, he was going to run with him again. A vote was going to be held in the Senate that day of the Bobby Baker scandal. Bobby Baker had been Lyndon's bagman when he was majority leader. Everyone was predicting that his reputation would be so tarnished that Jack couldn't run with him again. After the assassination, all that just disappeared. The sandals just evaporated. There was no vote in the Senate. And, of course, Lyndon went on to become the powerful president. Frank Sturgis said the Anacostro-Cubans that had been involved. Sam Giancana confessed to his brother, told his brother Chuck about their involvement of the CIA in taking out Jack. And, in fact, he published a book. The brother and a nephew published a book called Double Cross, because they claimed that they had had an agreement with the Kennedys, and they might have had an agreement with Joe, but neither John nor Bobby would have entered into anything like this. That if they helped Jack win the election by making sure that Illinois went for JFK, by, you know, with a daily machine in Chicago going big for Jack, in which all of which happened, that then they figured Jack would lay off, but instead Bobby initiated the most severe crackdown in organized crime in his history with a stunning number of indictments and convictions. So they felt betrayed. So when Sam Giancana tells his brother about all this, and they publish the book, they entitle it Double Cross, and there are two chapters about the collusion between the CIA and the mob and taking Jack out. So if Jack Valenti really had a serious interest in this, he could have walked across the street to Barnes & Noble and picked up Double Cross and known that his claim that no one had ever talked was complete rubbish. Here we have then Chauncey Holt, who, you know, I produced a 4.5-hour documentary. I did this already in 1964 after we discovered that the autopsy x-rays had been altered and that the brain had been substituted. And I eventually, when I discovered Chauncey was alive, I sent a copy to him. And to my astonishment, the phone rang at 5 a.m. in Duluth, Minnesota. It was Chauncey Holt telling me he'd sat up all night watching my documentary and I had it right. That very documentary is available to you today, right now, on that desk, if you are interested in seeing it. And I'll tell you, in no respect has it been superseded. And it goes through all the documents and records and all the individuals and groups who had the motives. And I go through the list of those who appear to have been involved in the assassination with detailed explanations beyond what I can present here. Charles Harrelson actually said he had shot JFK, but later when he was on tape, he said he'd been out of his mind when he said it, and the very fact that he said it showed that he had been out of his mind, which just reflects how intelligent these people are. These are very intelligent people. Jim Hicks claimed to have been a communication coordinator, and there are photographs of him in Dealey Plaza with an antenna hanging out his pocket. He also looks an awful lot like the guy who was photographed in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald. Jack Ruby not only made the remark I already attributed, that if somebody else had been the vice president, this wouldn't have happened. He made two other remarks of great interest. One was, the individuals and groups involved here was bizarre. And if you realize that this involved the vice president of the United States, the mafia, anti-Castro Cubans, the FBI, and, you know, the CIA in taking out the president of the United States, that's a bizarre arrangement. He also said, and they all had very tangible, practical motives. Well, Lyndon wanted to become president. J. Edgar wanted to stay on as director of the FBI. The CIA wanted to retain its power. The Joint Chiefs were disillusioned with Jack because he'd not only refused to invade Cuba against their unanimous recommendation, he'd also signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against their unanimous opposition, and now he was pulling our forces out of Vietnam, where they thought a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. And, of course, the bankers, the Texas oil men, wanted to preserve their oil depletion allowance, and Jack was already going to abolish or reform the Fed. I remember as a young Marine Corps officer having a bill with a red embossed imprint that said United States note instead of the green embossed imprint that said Federal Reserve note. I think Jack felt that rather than paying a private consortium for printing money for the United States at interest, that the United States would be better off printing its own money. He had thereby antagonized a powerful coalition of forces against him. And in fact, a brilliant book by James Douglas entitled JFK and the Unspeakable which has only been published in the last year and a half, traces his evolution from a cold warrior to a man of peace and provides a wonderful background for understanding what happened to JFK, why he was assassinated, and why it matters today. I mentioned Billy Saul. Both Madeline and Billy Saul published books about their experiences with Lyndon. Although Madeline loved Lyndon, she was convinced he was involved in the assassination. So was Billy Saul. And he's got a wonderful book called The Texas Legend, where he talks about his relationship with Cliff Carter and with Malcolm Mack Wallace that I find quite persuasive. By way of closing, let me observe that if the great newspapers of this country had wanted to publish the truth, they could have done so on Tom Wicker's huge cover story about the assassination, published Saturday, the day after the assassination. He talks about the reports from the physician that there was a wound to the throat that was an entry wound. Here on the inside of the paperback cover of their book, they show a wound too low to have exited at the throat, which means that this can't possibly be the magic bullet. The physician, Robert Shaw, who treated John Connolly, said that when shown the bullet that was alleged to have done all this damage, that it was most unlikely because he had removed more lead from John Connolly's wrist than was missing from that bullet. Another concern that that conservatives had was there was going to be a Kennedy dynasty, that JFK was going to serve two terms, and then Bobby two terms, and then Teddy two terms. And in a way, you can see what they feared, because he was opposed to the abuse of the people by powerful interests. He stood for the common good. He really was a great man of peace. I think there's real reason why the whole world still continues to adore and mourn John F. Kennedy, who, if I were to put it in a nutshell, would say that the man was assassinated because he thought he was president of the United States. And I'd be very pleased to take any questions you may have. Yes?
The statue, I'm really intrigued about the statue of one of the assassins in Cuba.
Tony Escudero. It's in Little Havana in Miami.
In Florida.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's not going to go up in Cuba. Listen, the two statesmen, who world leaders, who were most traumatized by JFK's death were Fidel Castro on the one hand and Nikita Khrushchev on the other. Nikita walked around dazed for a week. Fidel was just stunned when it happened. JFK had extended feelers. He wanted to normalize relationships with Cuba. There was even a meeting between a representative of JFK and of Fidel the very day of the assassination. I'm telling you how bad it was going on. I mean, what a transformation. So, no, you can find the statue of Tony Escudero in Little Havana in Miami. Yes. Yeah, that's incorrect. James Earl Ray, from alleged assassin of Martin Luther King. No, James Earl Ray had nothing to do with this. There is a fellow who claimed to have been an assassin by the name of James Files, and there is about 2-hour confession tape that James Files gave, where I assessed the tape for 2 television stations when it first appeared, and I discovered about 80% of what Files had to say was true, but he claimed he was sort of thrown into the assassin at the last minute, as though this were a casual thing on the morning of the assassination, and asked to pick out his shooting location behind the grassy knoll. And he said that he fired the shot to kill Jack, but I was able to discredit him on the following ground. He doesn't report the limo being brought to a halt. If he doesn't report the limo being brought to a halt, he wasn't there and didn't fire the shot. On the other hand, he talks about this high-velocity pistol called the Remington Fireball, a .223 high-velocity varmint gun that may well have been the round that hit Jack in the right temple. Yes? Do I what? Oh, yes. Let me mention, I have 2 websites that are going to be of great interest. One is a new blog I have at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. And if you go to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, you'll find I participated in a conference, a national conference on JFK at the University of North Dakota, and turned my PowerPoint presentation. It was similar but reduced. I mean, there are a lot of details in what I gave you today, but you can find a reduced version there that was a chapter, and it's also been turned into an automated PowerPoint. You can also find a lot of work I've done on 9/11 there. You can find work I've done on the death of Paul Wellstone there. We're in the middle of a 3-part blog. I put up the first 2 parts, and the third will be put up on Monday. There's a lot of good stuff on that blog. The other place I'd mention is I have a radio program where I do these 2-hour interviews on important subjects, including JFK, 9/11, the economy, Obama, the wars and all that. And you can find that at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. I also have yet a third website I've had for a long time, assassinationscience.com, which is a public issues website where there's a whole lot of stuff on JFK, some of my latest articles you wouldn't find on the blog. And also, if you scroll down, there's a tutorial on the faking of the Zapruder film by John Costella, who created a new version of the Zapruder film by removing two kinds of distortion from the frames. The version I was showing you here is far superior to anything you would have ever seen before because it's what we call the Costella combined cut. And then finally, Costello and I also co-edit an online journal for advanced study of the death of JFK at assassinationresearch.com. So there are four different websites I recommend to you. Yes?
How does Jackie survive the post-assassination the way she did? How does she survive with her style of the masses? And how does Senator Kennedy continue to hold his water on this? Follow-up.
Well,
the other thing is, what happens to Jack Jr. and his demise in Martha's Vineyard in the airplane crash?
Well, I'll answer all three questions. I mean, I believe Jackie married Aristotle Onassis because he was the richest man in the world, and she thought he was most likely to be able to provide her with the kind of security she felt she and the children needed. They had a very detailed marital agreement that even specified how often Aristotle could have sex with Jackie. So it was like that. As far as the family, Teddy wrote a letter to Ed Hoffman, the deaf mute I mentioned, who was up behind the grassy knoll and actually saw one of the gunmen disassemble his weapon and put it in a toolbox that was then carried away by somebody who was dressed like a construction worker. And Ed wrote to Teddy and to ask him about why the family didn't pursue it. And Teddy wrote back, and this is published in a book that was edited by a fellow named Sloan, who also edited The Last Dissenting Witness, a book about Gene Hill, where he explained that the family felt that the duly constituted authorities should be responsible for the investigation because if the family were to become involved, they would be suspected of having political motivation. Now, as far as John is concerned, well, I haven't studied it in great detail the way I have the death of Paul Wellstone. There are many features of the plane crash that are extremely suspicious, and I do believe that if the motive that has been proposed to me, which is that he was going to use the magazine George to run stories about the assassination of his father, is true, then I do believe that there would have been a sufficient reason to take him out. Bear in mind that the principal motive for taking out Bobby appears to have been that he was going to reopen the investigation. Now, if you go to my website, assassinationscience.com, and scroll down the menu bar, you'll find I have four articles about the death of John, as well as many other events. There's quite a lot about Paul Wellstone there, too. Yes?
Was there any involvement of H.W. Bush in this? I've heard reports that he was at Dallas at the time of the attack.
Well, it's very interesting because Jesse Curry, the chief of police, after he left that office, would publish what he called the JFK assassination file. He was the security expert for 7-Eleven stores, and it was only sold at 7-Eleven stores. But I obtained one of them, and I actually wrote an article about Oswald in my second book, Murder in Dealey Plaza, explaining how he could never have been convicted. But in the course of going through the Jesse Curry's book, I found a photograph of a group standing in front of the book depository building, and there was this kind of tall, lanky guy with his characteristic hunch over and his hands in his pocket. And so far as I know, I was the first to identify George Herbert Walker Bush standing right in front of the book depository on the afternoon of the assassination of JFK. He was deeply involved, by the way, with the CIA long before he became its director, at which time they claimed it was the first time a civilian with no previous agency experience was made director. Right. The fact is that the code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion was called Operation Zapata, that the Bush family oil rigging business was Zapata. I believe if it had prevailed, they would have had the concession for oil drilling all over the Caribbean. Two of the ships were rechristened right before the invasion. One was rechristened and named Houston. The other was rechristened and named Barbara. That's precisely what he did with his planes in World War II. Yeah.
Footage of Oswald's murder by Ruby has ever been edited or doctored in any way?
I have not, but I will tell you about that They delayed making the transfer. I mean, the whole thing was absurd, you know, to have all these reporters and everything when they're making a transfer of a, you know, a subject of an assassination like this. They changed Oswald into a dark sweater before they moved him, and I think the purpose was so that you couldn't see where the blood was gushing out because it was dark. You know, he could have been wounded anywhere. Anyone with an internal wound knows you're not supposed to be subjected to CPR. The first thing they did with Oswald was subject him to CPR. Who knows what could have happened in the ambulance ride to the hospital. Now, the fascinating aspect is I mentioned how Charles Crenshaw not only was the last physician to see JFK before he was wrapped in sheets and placed in this bronze casket. By the way, when he was delivered to the morgue at Bethesda, he was in a black hearse and he was in a shipping carton and in a body bag, which is indicative of their having taken the body to remove bullet fragments because they were, I'm convinced, different calibers. If you had two different calibers, then you know there at least had to be at least two different shooters. So they removed all these bullet fragments, probably at Walter Reed, before the body was taken to Bethesda for the official autopsy. But Gerald Custer, who was the x-ray technician who took the x-rays, told me how he was headed upstairs with the x-rays in his hand, exposed but not developed, when he saw the formal entourage with the gray Navy ambulance pull up in front of Bethesda. He wondered what in the world was going on because they already had the body under autopsy at Bethesda, and it was Jackie who was entering the building with Robert McNamara, and, you know, the gray ambulance then drove off, but the body was already there. So there was, you know, it had been removed from the casket probably during the flight and apparently offloaded. David Lifton has done a huge amount about this. Offloaded onto a helicopter and then, I believe, flown to Walter Reed for this examination. But there are a lot of interesting aspects to that. Now, the rest of your question was... Oh, about Jack Ruby. Oh, no. I don't believe, I'm not aware of any indications that there was any fakery there, but listen to this. So Charles Crenshaw is responsible for the treatment of Lee Oswald, right? And while he's looking after Oswald, he gets a notification from the operator for the hospital that he has a phone call. And he's not going to believe it, but it's from the President of the United States. So he goes to take his phone call, and hears this all-too-familiar booming voice, you know, do you know who this is? You know, and of course, you know, how are you going to mistake Lyndon's voice? And he says, yes, sir, you know, and he says, he wanted to know the condition of Oswald. And he said, well, you know, actually, it wasn't too bad. Well, he said he'd sent a man there for a deathbed confession. And Crenshaw was telling Lyndon that he didn't think there would be a deathbed confession because he didn't think he was going to die. But when he got back to the trauma room number 2, he found a very mysterious-looking guy in a trench coat who obviously was a designated deathbed confession taker. Oswald took a turn for the worse, however, and died, so Crenshaw explained to the man there would be no deathbed confession.
Yep. I would ask anybody to watch the YouTube shooting of Oswald, and there is a definite cut in what would assume to be a very precious sequence of time. It's only an 8 or 9 second film. Why you would ever cut anything out of it? You see a cut, and then either another camera picks it up or some frames are removed. It just simply jumps. And I don't know why they would have to change cameras.
Well, that's extremely interesting because, I mean, look, after what I've been through with JFK, I mean, I can't rule that out. I'll just say we've never noticed it. But I'll mention to Jack White in particular the point you're making here and see if Jack thinks there's something to it because he would be the guy. Somebody else. Yes.
Can you elaborate on the Hunt confession?
Yes. E. Howard Hunt was a longtime operative with the CIA. He wrote a lot of books, many of which appear to have been based on actual operations by the CIA. They were published as fiction. But he was, you know, in his waning days, and he, too, like Jack Ruby, appears to have had enough of a conscience that he wanted to come clean. So he prepared these tape recordings for his son, St. John, and eventually an article appeared in Rolling Stone entitled The Last Confession of E. Howard Hunt, and you can find it on a Google search. In my review of Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, which you can find archived on assassinationscience.com, you'll find that I integrate Hunt's confession with the other evidence we have from Bradley Ayers, from Madeline Duncan Brown, from Billy Saul Estes, and so forth, by way of conclusion in terms of the evidence that implicates Lyndon and other elements of this Central Intelligence Agency in the assassination. Yes. Bill's already, I did a discussion about thinking about conspiracy theories yesterday, and he's already got it up. So I say the man is a phenomenon. And And we'll see. But he's the guy. I mean, when I do have access and know where it is, I will certainly have links to it from my blog.
Which one are all of them?
Well, the jamesfetzer.blogspot.com is a place you kind of would turn for some of the latest state of research. But if you want to trace the history, go to Assassination Science. If you want more, go to Assassination Research. And then if you want to hear some of these radio interviews, go to Radio Fetzer. Yeah.
Yeah, just quick. Somebody rebuilding the inside of the limousine. Somebody changing the what happened. All this changing evidence. There must be some receipt, some way of tracing.
We have the bill from Ford Motor Company, which charged $1 million to rebuild. I published it in Assassination Science.
What individual, what person did this?
We tracked that down. If you go to Murder in Dealey Plaza and read the chapter by Doug Weldon, who's an attorney from Kalamazoo, Michigan, he tracked down the official who was responsible for rebuilding the limousine, replacing the windshield and all that. We've got him there by name.
That's criminal.
He worked for Ford Motor Company. He was following his instructions. He feared for his life. I'll just tell you this. So many of these people, like this Geneva Hine, who Robert Groden has just revealed was actually making change for Oswald at the time of the assassination so he could get his coat, was in fear of her life. She would not allow her name to be released. But now that she's gone, he's releasing it, and I'm sure he has recorded interviews with her to back it up. Yeah.
Well, Penn Jones, one of the original researchers, did put out a list of suspicious assassinations. And I think when he quit, I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, Jim, he had a list of about 250 suspicious deaths. And that was decades ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they weren't messing around here. There's a book by John Armstrong and Craig Roberts entitled JFK, The Dead Witnesses, that inventories 100. Let me give you one example that's a very interesting case. Dorothy Kilgallen, the rather celebrated syndicated columnist, had a one-on-one interview with Jack Ruby. And apparently, Ruby was very candid with her. She made the mistake, however, of saying that she was going to blow the case wide open. And the next thing we know is that she's dead from a barbiturate overdose. She did use barbiturates, but she was very careful about their use and would not have given herself an overdose. All of her notes and records from the interview were missing. And within days, her closest personal friend in whom she might have been expected to confide was also found dead. So this is very typical of the modus operandi here, of leaving no loose ends. The whole idea was that no one was ever supposed to be punished in any way, shape, or form for participating in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
I noticed Barry Seal's photo in that Rose Gallery. Can you touch upon his involvement?
I don't have a lot to say about Barry Seal. I mean, he is there. Let me go back and find...
Absolutely.
Yeah. There are aspects and individuals here that I have not done research on, and Barry Seal would be an example of one of them. I mean, I could speak about a number of these individuals, but not all of them. So that's.
You know, Hapsiger wrote a book on Seal.
Very important.
Yeah.
And the theme of that was.
Can't be in that book.
And, going back to the Civil Air Patrol days, Oswald.
Oh, he was supposed to have been involved in that civilian air patrol with David Ferry, where Oswald was learning to be a pilot. Interesting. Yeah, please.
So, some people think that Marilyn Monroe was killed, and she had an affair with Kennedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgive anyone for having an affair with Marilyn, but, if you were to go into my, I have an office behind French doors where I do my radio shows. And on the wall there's this five-part print of the early Marilyn. I'm a huge fan of Marilyn. Outside my library, there's a photo of the Beatles, one of those famous, they are two of my favorite people. Now, Jack had a dalliance with Marilyn, there's no doubt about it, but it wasn't serious. Apparently, she and Bobby had a thing that was serious, and she actually thought Bobby might divorce Ethel and marry her. This was, of course, a bit fantastic. Now, the day she died, Bobby was there because she was acting suicidal on the phone, apparently. And Bobby visited, I think, to pacify her. She was later found dead, and as best I can tell, Marilyn was killed by a barbiturate overdose that was administered rectally to take her out. And it's, she was already unconscious when this occurred. apparently the mob had bugged her house. They knew all about this, and they actually wanted to embarrass Bobby and to make it look as though he had to do with it, though it never played out that way. I will say the Los Angeles police, however, when Bobby was assassinated, performed not just with reckless incompetence, but with criminal neglect in the way they handled the evidence. There were more bullets fired in the pantry than came from Sirhan's gun. Sirhan was never closer than a foot and a half to Bobby. Bobby was shot behind the right ear from an inch and a half. A security guard by the name of Caesar was staying behind Bobby with the same quality, same caliber weapon, and he appears to have fired the bullet that killed Bobby Kennedy. And he was later discovered to have rather strong anti-Kennedy attitudes and so forth. And they just dismantled that whole pantry. And the medical examiner, who is a very famous forensic pathologist, concluded that the actual way in which Bobby had been killed was different than the police report. So what happened was the medical examiner was fired instead of the police chief of police. I mean, it was really a ridiculous thing. And you get these stories about how, well, you know, Dallas had got its Kennedy and L.A. wanted its Kennedy. I grew up in Southern California. I was born in Pasadena. I graduated from South Pasadena High School. I mean, the idea that the L.A. police were culpable in the assassination of Bobby Kennedy just makes me sick. But then you see the deep, dark cesspool into which we've entered here with the assassination of JFK. So many powerful individuals and groups were involved in his assassination, yes.
I'm familiar with Madeline Brown.
Oh, yeah, I had more than 100 conversations with Madeline Brown. Well, Madeline was a little prominent. You know, taking out Madeline would have been a bit much. Huh? Yeah, well, they haven't killed me either, right? You know, sometimes I say, you know, well, why is it? And the fact of the matter is, you know, Madeline was well known. They knew Madeline's story. I mean, everybody knew that. I'm talking in Dallas, where this crime would have to have been committed. Okay, everyone would have known. It would have increased suspicion. Madeline was a very familiar person. She wrote a book. It's entitled Texas in the Morning. It was based upon the fact that when she and Lyndon would have these rendezvous, he'd wake up in the morning, throw open the window, and say, "God, I love Texas in the morning." Okay, and she talked about him, you know, and Lyndon used to boast that he had more women by accident than JFK had on purpose, and it may even be true, okay? This is an aside, but Jack Valenti married one of Lyndon's secretaries, and this may be an aspect of his motivation for wanting to defend his reputation, such that when the men who killed Kennedy, Nigel Turner, this brilliant British director, published three new installments. There had been an original five, then there was a sixth, about a research by a guy named Tom Wilson that used computer application to the back of the skull and so forth. Then 7, 8, and 9, 7 was a smoking gun that featured David Mandick and Vincent Palomara and me and others about the evidence. Then there was a number 8 was called The Love Affair, about a relationship between Oswald and Judith Berry Baker, whom at the time I doubted had this relationship with Oswald, but who I have now come to believe is actually the real deal and did know Oswald in New Orleans, and I'm now a supporter of Judith, although her identification and claims has been a source of much controversy. But the last installment, 9, The Guilty Men, was all about the event at the Murchison home that night. They had the chauffeur there who confirmed he'd driven J. Edgar Hoover there. They had a chef there who confirmed they were serving food for this group of people I've described, and Lyndon's presence and all that, and you had Madeline involved there, and I think also Billy Saul, whose book is really quite convincing. I mean, you got to understand, Billy Saul was this con man who made all kinds of money for Lyndon Johnson and John Connolly and their cronies by swindles, like one where they got a huge loan from the Agriculture Department, which then was suspicious of the collateral. It was a huge grain allotment, as I recall. Maybe didn't exist. So they sent out an investigator by the name of Henry Marshall. Henry Marshall was found shot 5 times with a single-shot bolt-action rifle. He'd been clubbed over the head. His lungs were filled with carbon monoxide. But in the Texas of that day, the Justice of the Peace declared it to be a suicide. This is one of Mack Wallace's killings for Lyndon Johnson. So I just tell you, you know, if you dig deep enough, Madeline was terrific. And I interviewed her at a conference in Dallas in 1998, I believe, where we just pull up 2 overstuffed chairs. And I asked Madeline questions about her story because I knew it so well. And in about a half an hour, we had the whole story, which you can obtain from JFK Lancer Productions if you were interested. Yeah.
If you sum up the celebrity personalities of the era, say that collectively the motive was the system killed them and they were back to business as usual?
Well, I think it's a little different, but you're not altogether off on that. I mean, I have given some thought to this business about the role of assassination. It's very difficult to get the public motivated to want to face major reforms of the status quo. But Jack Kennedy had that capacity. Bobby, in my opinion, had even more. I have often said I would gladly have given my life for Bobby Kennedy, and I absolutely mean that. Jack, I adore. But I tell you, Bobby struck me in a visceral way. Taking out Martin Luther King, I think that was very much to do with a hatred, act of hatred by J. Edgar Hoover. I think that was very personal, but of course there was tremendous resentment of this guy for being a black civil rights leader. Malcolm appears to have had to do with a power tussle inside the black movement. But he was another charismatic, progressive leader. If you actually study what Malcolm X stood for, he was in ways even more progressive than Bobby and Martin. So, I mean, if you can decapitate the leaders of the progressive left, then you really don't have much to fear because it's so difficult to bring the people to a point where they're sufficiently motivated to support important change. Yes?
Is there any compelling evidence that Wellstone was murdered?
I've done a huge amount on this. Absolutely. I mean, I published 10 columns, a book, and did additional research with John Costella. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, this will give you a hint of where to go. If you go to my blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and you'll see the two blogs that are up, and there will be a third on Monday about Wellstone. I mean, this is just purely coincidental. But without recapping all of the evidence, the NTSB cannot investigate a plane crash as a crime scene unless the Attorney General declares it to be one, which means that if you have a complicit or compliant Attorney General, you've got the perfect mechanism for taking out your political opponents. You take him out, and then he simply declines to declare it a crime scene. This is also the case that NTSB reports, and this is utterly stunning, are not admissible as evidence in courts of law. So I say, so what in God's name are they all about, okay? I'll tell you, they only investigated the plane, the pilot, the weather. The weather was just fine. It was grossly exaggerated over the air. The pilots were well qualified. One had the chief pilot, Richard Connery, had 5,200 hours of experience in air transport pilot's certification, which is the highest civilian short of astronaut, and had just passed his FAA flight check 2 days before, and which means that he was, by government's own standards, qualified to fly the plane. They didn't need two pilots, but they had two pilots. And the plane was like the Rolls-Royce of small planes. They never investigated the possibility of a small bomb, a gas canister, or some kind of high-tech electromagnetic weapon, which I'm convinced was, in fact, what was used here. But I've laid it out in spades many places, and I recommend try that. There is a piece, by the way, that I published on Op-Ed News when Seymour Hersh revealed that there had been an assassination ring run out of the vice president's office because Dick Cheney had threatened Paul Wellstone personally. If he opposed him on Iraq, he told him there would be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. He went ahead and spoke out courageously, thinking he might be ending his political career. Instead, his points started to increase. His lead went to 6, 7, 8 points. And then he was taken out, which, of course, had the effect of giving control of the Senate to the Republicans. It removed their foremost critic, who had been targeted for elimination by the vaunted Bush machine. There's a tremendous amount of supporting evidence for what I'm telling you here. So there's also an article on Op-Ed News, you can Google entitled, Did Cheney Murder Americans? And the answer to that you may be able to infer from what I've said already. I can't thank you enough for turning out tonight here in Portland. It's been my pleasure to be here with you all. And I thank you. Thank you all so very much for coming.
Can everyone take a chair up? It would save us a lot of work.